Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Fish and Game Commission meeting for March 4th, 2009. I'd like to introduce and welcome all of you here today. Thank you for attending, and also introduce to you our commission and key staff members that are sitting with us up here at the table. First off, myself, I'm Cindy Gustafson. I'm president of the commission this year, and I live in Tahoe City, California, where we had about 18 inches of snow last night, and I had quite an adventure getting down here. Commissioner, our vice president of our commission, Jim Kellogg, is unfortunately not with us today. A family member has had some medical issues, and our thoughts are with Jim and his family. Richard Rogers is our past president and a member from Carpinteria, California. Michael Sutton, to my left, is a commissioner from Monterey, California.
Morning.
And next to Richard is Daniel Richards from Upland, California. Also sitting here at the dais is John Carlson, executive director of the Fish and Game Commission. And leaning over there, for those of you who can see him, is John Fisher, deputy executive director. Adriana Shea is also not with us today as our other deputy executive director. Adriana, we know you're watching, and we hope you recover quickly as well. She recently broke an ankle and is a little hobbled up. Also with us this morning, we have Sherry Fonbueno, is that correct, Sherry? I'm sorry. And Anita Biederman and Carol Horn all over at this table with our staff. And if you have any speaker cards, you can turn them in over there. Any exhibits, you can turn them in over there. We're also honored today to have the director of the department, Donald Cook, and Chief Deputy Director John McCammon, and Deputy Director Sankey Mastrup with us from the department. Also is Eric Loft. I thought I saw Eric here earlier. There he is back there with us. And on duty today, although we have a number of wardens in attendance, on duty today we have Chief Deputy Director Nancy Foley. I'm sorry, Chief of Enforcement Nancy Foley, and Lieutenant John Winings. And with that, we'll... Oh, and Deb Barnes. I'm sorry, Deb. Our Attorney General's Representative Deb Barnes with us. Okay.
Thank you. I'd like to remind everyone that today's proceedings are being videotaped and it is being live streamed across the internet. So keep in mind what you say is on film. And we also offer a free service that our meetings and then the archive of the video is available through our website, which is linked to the AGP video website. So for about the last 7 years, if you have a meeting that you're interested in looking up an agenda item, you can go to our website and link into that, and that kind of comes in handy. We also want to remind everyone that today is a Bagley-Keene dictates how we run this public meeting, and we really public disturbances are not acceptable during the meeting. If you want to speak on an item, turn in a green speaker's card for your agenda item, but no comments from the audience or disturbances from the audience. We also have a 10-minute aggregate total time of comments from every individual today, so if you're going to speak on multiple items, please choose wisely. We're going to start with our public forum, and any member of the public may address and or ask questions of the commission relating to the implementation of its policies and any other matter within the jurisdiction of the commission. As a general rule, action cannot be taken on issues not listed on the agenda. Staff will normally be requested to follow up on such items at the discretion of the commission. Submittal of written comments is encouraged to ensure that all comments be included in the record before the commission. Please be prepared to summarize your comments within 3 minutes. We have a couple of speaker cards for public forum. We start off with Pamela Flick, followed by Paul Weekland.
Thanks, Steve. Good morning, Commissioners. Pamela Flick with Defenders of Wildlife.
out of Sacramento. I'm just here to follow up on some lead ammunition information that was presented to the commission last month. Dan Taylor from Audubon, California mentioned this, and I didn't see him this morning, but the Peregrine Fund and others have put together the proceedings from their lead conference from last May, and I have a copy here to present to the commission for your information. Also, the Wildlife Society has come up with its technical review, and they just published it last June, about sources and implications of lead ammunition and fishing tackle on natural resources. Fortunately, this is my only copy, but I intend to get a copy to the commission within the next month.
Paul Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. We are here again because you are not effectively or efficiently managing the abalone resource in the state of California. Requesting that you immediately open for the harvest of abalones where there are large numbers of harvestable abalone, sustainable fishing in the counties of San Francisco, San Mateo, Santa Cruz, Monterey, and San Luis Obispo counties. It's kind of ridiculous that you've gone on this long leaving the door open so slightly so you can study and squander millions of dollars in surveys showing that you are not managing the resource in a proper fashion. Also, we'd like to discuss the swindlers and cheats in aquaculture and how they have been no accountability and allowed to do whatever they want. And they have infested and infected our waters with diseases and parasites, but you want to eliminate that from the record. I think there's some kind of laws against eliminating the eyesores from the record, purging from the files the truth and the record that has occurred. Wait. Want to buy some shares in an aquaculture pyramid? How about some stock in a mariculture Ponzi consortium? That's all.
We have one more public forum speaker, Ken Barnes.
Good morning. Thank you. I'll be brief. Want to applaud Commissioner Rogers for recusing himself from the meeting in February for the conflict of interest that he saw, and we appreciate that. I did just want to briefly ask that Commissioner Sutton, with regards to the Marine Life Protection Act, because of a financial conflict of interest, disqualify himself and recuse himself for it. I have for you, I'm not sure who the clerk is. Oh, thank you. It's a 23-page document. I encourage you all to review it, and thank you for your time.
Excuse me, Mr. Barnes, if I may. Sorry. If you'd get back on the microphone, just so that, for the record. Thank you for your commentary. Do you represent any group or?
I put it all into the.
You did.
Into the packet, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, so
thank you.
Thank you.
We'll get that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. No other public forum speakers that I know of. Walt. So somehow we don't have that card. Yeah, I don't have it. But go ahead, Walt.
There he is. We found your card.
Okay, Walt, I guess we'll let you speak today. Thank you.
Walt Mansell, representing the California Rifle and Pistol Association. I just want to say we introduced and we gave a supply of little firearms law booklets and firearm safety booklets to your staff for each of you for this year. And also I would like to introduce Tom Pedersen, who many of you know, who will be replacing me as the liaison with your commission most of the time. They voted me to some other office, and we'll look forward to seeing you occasionally as we go through the years. Thank you.
Thank you, Walt.
And I'd like to add, Walt, for the commissioners who are newer commissioners, Tom Pedersen is Nancy Foley's predecessor. Tom Pedersen was the chief of enforcement for California Fish and Game, and when he retired, Nancy came on board. You want to say a few things, Tom?
Yes.
Thanks.
Good morning, Madam President, members of the Commission. My name is Tom Pedersen, and I'll be representing the California Rifle and Pistol Association at times regarding matters that are of interest, hopefully, to the commission and our association. And I'd just like to thank your executive director for those kind words. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I guess now we don't have any more speaker cards for public forum. Move us on to item number two, presentation of the Warden of the Year Award. Director Don Cook can take that away, and then the commission will have some things to say also.
Thank you, John. Good morning, everybody. I want to thank the commission for affording us the opportunity to present Warden Pirtle with the Officer of the Year Award today. As you're painfully aware, we've had to cancel numerous fish and game gatherings because of budget constraints, the amount of money it costs us just to get people all in one spot. And so this is a really high honor for Sean, and we wanted to make sure there was an opportunity for Sean to receive it in public, and knowing your support for the law enforcement function, wanted to give you that opportunity as well. I'm not going to say much more. I'm going to ask Nancy to come up, but I do want to just let the commission know, when I had a real job in the 80s with the department, I had the opportunity to work with Sean's father and in the field, and he was a great warden, and it was a pleasure. So Sean's second generation. So Nancy.
Commissioners, I'd also like to thank you for this opportunity. It's not often enough that we get to recognize people that have done good deeds for the department in a public venue. And when our Advanced Officer Training Awards luncheon was canceled, we thought that this was the most appropriate other venue to get the word out about some of the things that game wardens have been doing. And because of your strong support and the President's allowance, we're here today to recognize not only the Warden Officer of the Year, but also to provide you with the names of other people that would have been recognized at our awards luncheon. And so I'll just run down those names. We only have one of the other awardees here. And so as we get to his name, then I'll recognize him as well. But we have several awards that are provided from some of our partners, one of them being the National Wild Turkey Federation Officer of the Year. And no, it's not the Turkey of the Year award that we give out, but Warden Barry Saccone from the Northern Enforcement District won that and went back to Tennessee just last week to receive his award from the Wild Turkey Federation. The Shikar Safari Officer of the Year was retired Assistant Chief Chris Patton. We had 10 people that received life-saving awards. Those were John Castro, Christian Corbo, Stephen Johnson, Don Powers, Warden Josh Brennan, who is here, Lieutenant Eric Cord, Rodney Buckler, Rob Rojas, Justin Sandvig, and Patrick Foy. And so, it just goes to show you that we're out there a lot, and the game wardens do some tremendous things to save people's lives. And we're giving out one Distinguished Service Medal to Warden Wilbur Brown this year. We talked about the Governor's Medal of Valor Award winners before. That was Warden Wilbur Brown, Warden Liz Gregory, and again, Warden Josh Brennan, who is in the room. Josh?
Could you just stand up? Thank you.
So then we get on to the Officer of the Year, and we have some criteria that we, along with the Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, meet this criteria for our Officer of the Year. The criteria are their contributions to fish and wildlife enforcement, exceptional leadership, skill, or ingenuity in the performance of their duties, contributions to areas of applied technology in fish and wildlife enforcement, and contributions that brought credit to their agency or the field of fish and wildlife enforcement that were unique or original. And this year, Sean Pirtle certainly reached all of those criteria and was also nominated as our Pogue Elms Award winner and supplied that name to the Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, and he was the Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies Officer of the Year as well. So Mike Carrion will give you some of the criteria is some of the things that Sean actually did to get this award, and then we'll bring Sean up here.
Thank you, Chief Foley. Good morning, Commissioners. I'd like to read you just a short paragraph of a synopsis of how Sean was nominated for this, and then give you a couple of examples of the type of work that Sean has been involved with. Warden Sean Pirtle has grown up in the department. The son of a game warden, Warden Pirtle spent his summer riding along with his father, learning the fish and wildlife and the ways of a game warden. Warden Pirtle is an avid sportsman and spends time becoming an expert in the wildlife that he pursues. Warden Pirtle also relentlessly pursues those that violate the law. He does not hesitate to take the lead on even the most complex investigations and follows those cases closely through the court system. Warden Pirtle uses his training and experience to develop quality cases and applies his ingenuity in investigation. Some examples of this are camouflaging a trail camera in a rock wall to catch images of an individual checking illegal snares, and the use of a radio tracking antenna to convince a suspected turkey poacher that the bird that he had killed contained a radio tracking device. That resulted in a confession. Due to his professionalism, he has established an excellent working relationship with both his local courts and the district attorney's office. This relationship has led to effective prosecution of violators, garnering substantial fines and penalties. The list of Sean Pirtle's accomplishments goes on and on. I have several pages here, and I'm not going to go over all of that, but I do want to give you a couple of examples. There was a situation in the Sutter Buttes area where 13 deer had been poached over a month or so period of time. Several of those were does and fawns. Sean worked with the local law enforcement agencies to get the word out. They were able to start garnishing some leads as to who the suspects were, and eventually, after about a two-month investigation, he was able to get a confession from the people that were involved with that throw killing of 13 deer. There's an example of him working on bear season, out-of-season bear poachers, and the fact that he found some of them with bears in trees, and they said that they were actually just hunting coyotes with their dogs, but he was able to get a hold of the dogs, follow the dogs to the bear in the tree, gather enough information to show that they were in fact poaching bear, get a warrant for the people involved, and found out that there were people there that were felons in possession of firearms and have arrest warrants as a result of that. It is a relentless pursuit of these poachers, and I'll tell you that it wasn't just this 2 years ago when this work happened and again last year, but continuing on with this past season, Sean holds an extremely high caseload, and his cases are all involved with resource type violations. He has made a tremendous number of over-limit cases and waterfowl baiting cases involving both deer and dove, and it's just phenomenal in the type of work that he does. And so there was little doubt in anybody's mind when his name came up as the Officer of the Year first to be able to recognize him. Thank you very much.
So this is Warden Sean Pirtle, our Officer of the Year, and we have a few things that we generally give out as the award winner. This is the Bear Award that we give. It's engraved with Sean's name on it in the year that he was received as the Officer of the Year. And then our partners with Ducks Unlimited provided a print that will also be given to Sean at this time. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commission, and Chief Foley and Chief Carrion. It's a tremendous honor. It's not a single-handed job. I have to say I had a lot of help in all those cases with my squad, Nate Stebbins and Cody Gamble, and I'm standing here on behalf of other wardens that are probably better than I, and one being Josh Brennan, which I often call for advice, and gave me the information on how to put these cases together. But it's a tremendous honor, and thank you all. And the biggest supporter in my career is my wife. I couldn't have done a quarter of that without her. She probably knows more about writing a search warrant than most narcotics officers, and puts the reports together so it all looks good. So it's a quarter me and three quarters her. So I have to thank her above all. Yeah. Thank you.
Sean. Sean. If you could stay up here for just a moment, we have one public comment that we want to take, and then the commission has something to give you as well. So if you don't mind just taking a seat here, and we'll move
to Walt Manziel.
President Augustus and members of the commission, the California Rifle and Pistol Association applauds the awards for Sean. Mr. Pirtle, as was our enjoyment to be able to work with his dad quite a while in different assignments. Many times, game wardens labor in obscurity, total obscurity. The deer and the raccoons and the rabbits and the ducks and whatever don't call in and say, this guy did a good job. And it's a real pleasure to see this recognition go to a game warden. And probably in California, if you beat the bushes and check the trees, you'd find another 50 or 100 game wardens deserving of also exceptional recognition. Thank you.
You're so correct with that, Walt. We really appreciate everything everyone does. John has a statement from the commission we'd like to read to you, Sean.
Yes, this is a resolution honoring Mr. Sean Pirtle. And before I get too far into this on a personal note, I have had the pleasure of being on pheasant hunt with Sean a couple of years back, and he is relentless against those pheasants also, I have to say. And it was a lot of fun. I'm just going to read a couple of excerpts here because a lot of this has been covered. But one thing that I want to bring up here under this resolution is, whereas you have completely turned around the working relationship with the Yuba County District Attorney's Office, where due to your tireless efforts to increase the awareness of the importance of fish and game cases, substantial fines and penalties have been garnered after the district attorney's office has pursued the cases vigorously and prosecuted those individuals charged. That's something the commission is very concerned about with DAs, and this is great that you have been able to pull that off. We also want to recognize that you have championed the positive image of all game wardens nationwide by hosting a film crew producing a half-hour special for the Outdoor Channel about professionalism and the positive images portrayed by game wardens in contacts with youth waterfowl hunters. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the California Fish and Game Commission hereby recognizes and honors you, Sean Pirtle, as the California Fish and Game Officer for the year 2008. Further, be it resolved that the commission wishes you future success as you continue to serve and protect the fish and wildlife resources and the people of our Golden State. And finally, let it be resolved that the commission applauds your passion of conserving all things wild and pursuing those who do not respect the resources you are sworn to protect. At this point, we would like all the commissioners to go up to present this to Sean and get this on the film on camera, since we don't have any photographers, it looks like.
Well, again, I'd like to congratulate Sean, but also to thank all of our dedicated wardens and law enforcement officers out there in the field. You're really so appreciated by this commission and by those of us who use the resources in the state of California for all your efforts to protect them. And again, just congratulations, Sean, and to all of you. Thank you.
As the only former game warden on the commission, I want to echo. It was bad enough when I was a game warden in terms of low pay, long hours, pretty thin on the ground, and now it's even worse, especially in California. There's no excuse for it. We're all concerned about it, and I just want you all to know we're trying to do something about it. Whatever it takes politically, whatever it takes in terms of finding sources of funds, which of course everyone knows are scarce in California these days, we will do whatever we can to help you all in the field. So thanks again for your service.
Should we move on?
Thank you. Item number three, presentation regarding becoming an Outdoors Woman California organization. Susan Hergesell. Susan is a former department employee who recently retired and has been involved in the Outdoors Women program for many, many years. She's going to give us kind of some history on the program and an update on where they are today and where they're heading. It's a very exciting program here in California. Thanks, Susan.
John. There we go. Good morning. Like John said, my name is Susan Hergesell. I'm president of Becoming an Outdoors Woman, California, also referred to as BOW. Thanks, John, and the commission for inviting me here today to talk about the organization. Within the Department of Fish and Game, I coordinated the BOW program from 1997 to 2003. I've just recently retired after almost 30 years with the department to spend more time expanding this very important program in California. I believe that California needs the Becoming an Outdoors Woman organization. And let me tell you who we are and what we do, and I'll start with the mission statement. Becoming an Outdoors Woman California is a nonprofit organization dedicated to offering women opportunities to learn outdoor skills in a safe, encouraging, and supportive environment. Instruction is given in a 1, 2, or 3-day workshop with valuable hands-on experiences. Workshops are designed to foster the learning process and provide the opportunity for women to enjoy the outdoors while encouraging and empowering them to build their self-confidence in the outdoors and in life's adventures. We offer outdoor skills training in a balanced framework. There truly is something for everyone. A third of the program offers instruction in hunting and shooting skills, and it includes shotgun, archery, bow hunting, rifle, and hunting. We offer waterfowl and pheasant hunts, and with the sponsorship of California Deer Association, we may be including a big game hunt. A third of the program offers instruction in fishing skills: fly fishing, fly tying, spin casting, bait fishing, freshwater, and saltwater. One of my best friends and one of BOW's fly fishing instructors, Sally Stoner, wrote in her book, "After a few hours of being completely enchanted by the process of casting a fly to elusive fish, most beginners emerge from the water with renewed spirits. The furrowed brows and deep lines etched by tension around their eyes are replaced with smiles and voices trilling with enthusiasm. In a transformation as amazing as the metamorphosis of aquatic insects, new anglers find a life-giving elixir in the restorative effects of fly fishing." And that's really what BOW is all about, transformation. And then a third of the program offers instruction in non-consumptive outdoor activities. Many of these activities can be related to hunting and fishing or can stand alone. We offer kayaking, canoeing, outdoor cooking, personal self-defense, birding, drawing, map and compass, using a GPS, wildlife ID, camping and backpacking, cross-country skiing, wilderness survival, and more. You can see there truly is something for everyone. I want to give you a brief overview of BOW's very long history. It was created at the University of Wisconsin in 1990 as a result of a conference titled "Breaking Down the Barriers to Participation of Women in Angling and Hunting." The Barriers Conference was attended by 65 participants and speakers who represented a diversity of interest groups: hunters and anglers, fish and game management agencies, both state and federal, manufacturers, and media. They identified the barriers to women's participation in hunting and fishing, and these are just a few. Most of all, it was the expense and availability of suitable equipment and clothing, lack of information and where to go to get that. The image of the sport as portrayed by anti-hunting movement was a big turnoff. Societal pressures, cultural barriers, and more. Now, this was the early 1990s, and we've come a ways. Just look at Cabela's catalog. In the early 1990s, the women's section was a couple of pages, typically with sweaters with bunnies on them. Now Cabela's produces a women's catalog. We have one of our own. In response to the conference, their findings, the BOW workshop format was created. A balanced program offered in a supportive, non-threatening environment. It was a huge success. And one of the benefits was that hunting and fishing license sales increased in the subsequent years. And a study found that attending a BOW workshop has had the following quantifiable impacts on participants. Increased activity in outdoor recreation. Increased interest in resource management. Increased purchase of hunting and fishing licenses and park permits. And a more positive attitude toward the state natural resources management agencies. With the success of the program, the Department of Fish and Game brought the program to California in 1994 and sponsored 2 3-day multi-course workshops, one in Northern California and one in Southern California. Recognizing all of the positive impacts, in 1995, the program was sponsored by the Natural Resources Agencies in 46 states. 6 Canadian provinces and New Zealand followed soon thereafter. The program flourished in California, and by 2002, the program had grown to 13 workshops statewide. It was so successful that a lottery system had to be instituted. There was a waiting list for every workshop. And then, unfortunately, in 2003, with the severe budget crisis, the program was cut from the department. Well, at that time, I received hundreds of phone calls and emails and letters asking me to keep the program going. I really didn't quite know where to go. I knew that women needed somewhere to go and learn to participate in these activities. This program changes the lives of women, and I felt I needed to continue that effort in California. So in 2005, I gathered a group of friends and professionals, not exclusive, and started the nonprofit organization. And you can see the 2009 schedule of events, and I've also, there they are, included that information in your packets. And in 2009, we're still going strong. However, we are looking for support. Let me tell you what BOW has to offer any sponsor or partner. We are a 501c3. That means a tax deduction for anyone who donates. We have top-quality equipment, new Browning and Remington shotguns, Genesis bows, Sage fly rods and reels, Garmin GPSs and compasses, audiovisual equipment, loophole binoculars, all donated by the manufacturers who share our mission. We have a copyrighted name and recognizable logo. We are a known commodity. Part of an international organization, we're supported by a parent company. We have a proven leadership team. We've succeeded even through perilous times. We have a cadre of more than 60 professional instructors, all dedicated to this organization. Hundreds of volunteers, people who design brochures, attend trade shows, distribute flyers, speak at outdoor recreation conferences, and the like. We have supportive media contacts. BOW has been featured on all major television networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox, the History Channel, the Outdoor Channel, radio programs, and in all major newspapers in California. We depend on our sponsors, and sponsors who donate their efforts, their time, their products, and their money. These sponsors are who keep BOW alive. And as you can see, we're supported by some state and federal agencies. I would like to mention that BOW would not have survived without Wilderness Unlimited sponsorship. I have to thank Rick Copeland. We were given their properties to host the workshops. We were given their equipment before we got our own, and we were given the use of their instructors. I just have to say thank you to all of our sponsors. Our future goals. We want to expand the database by sharing information with other like-minded organizations, making us more desirable to partners and supporters. We want to secure a corporate sponsor. We believe that there exists some organization or foundation who shares our mission and will support BOW with a monetary grant to cover insurance, instructor stipends, advertising, office supplies, equipment, etc. Our goal is to find that entity and partner for the benefit of the women of California. We want to develop partnerships. Partnerships expand the possibilities. They create win-win situations. Partnerships share the load. And we are all better together. And now you know why I think California needs the BOW organization. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Susan.
You're welcome.
That was a great presentation.
Thank you.
Were there public comments or commissioner comments?
I think we have trouble.
Do you? Do you guys want to say anything? We've got the Rifle and Pistol Association.
Good morning again, Madam President, members of the Commission. Tom Pedersen with California Rifle and Pistol Association. I would just like to express our support of BOW. I had the pleasure in my former life as a member of the department working with Susan. She's very enthusiastic. They've done an excellent job of building a program in spite of some of the financial problems that have evolved in this economy. And I would just like to state California Rifle and Pistol Association's support for this program. In fact, we're actually going to be in discussion with Susan and her entity regarding possible sponsorship of some sort or partnering. And once again, I'd just like to reiterate how important we think the program is. Thank you.
Thank you.
Richard?
Yeah, I'd like to weigh in on that as well, Susan. Thank you for that really illuminating presentation. That was I knew of the program, but I didn't realize the extent to which you guys have been operating successfully for so long. The fact that you are persistent in a very difficult economic environment since 2003 or approximately then is testimony to the tremendous need and demand for the things that you guys offer. I can't imagine that there wouldn't be a significant number of potential sponsors for your organization, because it certainly is in their vested interest to support you. I think it's a grand program.
Thank you. Susan, can I ask a question?
Sure.
What is a sponsorship? What is the financial cutoff for a sponsorship? What is the amount?
Right now, we get money through grants. I write lots of grant proposals, and our sponsors donate what they can. But it's specific. NRA gives us about $8,000 a year, and it's specific to guns, ammo, clays, things like that. We need a sponsor, and we're thinking around $50,000 a year for 3 years. After that, we will have built our database so big that we will be standalone. And hopefully, my goal, my personal goal, is that we can stand on the other side and say, come to us. We will be your sponsor. So that's my goal within about 3 years.
That's great. And on the bottom end, some of the sponsors that you listed up on the screen before, what is the minimum contribution to be a sponsor?
$5,000 for sponsorship.
Well, I know that this might make some folks uncomfortable, but I noticed the department wasn't up on that screen, and and the State Department of Parks and Rec was. So I'd like to urge us to look at what we can do. I know these are dire budgetary times, but this is such a worthwhile program, and anything we can do to help support you as well, personally from the commissioners as well as from the department, we'd love to continue to support you.
Thank you.
And certainly your goal of and making sure that everyone heard what you said, that we really you need a sponsor to cover those insurance costs and those office costs, and you're looking for someone to step up, or maybe multiple partners to step up. So,
definitely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Susan, what's your annual budget for this program? How much does it cost to operate it every year?
Probably about $50,000. About. Our instructor, each and every one of us who spends almost full time are volunteers at this point.
Okay.
Great write-offs at the end of the year. but, you know, not no money coming to us. We've been building it, and so we've been getting equipment and printers and laptops and things like that. So all of the money that we get through the workshops, we charge for the workshops, and the money above what we get is what goes to support us.
The reason I ask is that $50,000 a year is an exceptionally small budget for a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the biggest problem most of us have in raising money is a paucity of ambition. We don't think we can, so we don't try.
Yeah.
One suggestion I'd have, having raised a lot of money in my time, is that there are a lot of private foundations out there that are dedicated to wildlife conservation. Mm-hmm. The Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, for example, is a variety of hunting and fishing groups that are focused on habitat and species conservation. To the extent that you are distilling in your members or your participants a conservation ethic,
yes,
a la Aldo Leopold and so forth, you may find that you have more sources of potential funding than you realize. And I'd be happy to share some of those private foundation leads with you if you like.
I would really appreciate that. Small amounts. When we started the nonprofit, we thought about memberships, and what we actually call them are personal sponsorships. And you can go on the website and you can donate $40, $50, absolutely, and that will get you 10% off of any of the workshops.
One assumes that also. And on the website, do you have actually your 501c3 number so people can actually know how to take the donation?
No. We were counseled not to put that on the website.
But a way for them, people who make a donation, to access that.
Oh, yes.
Numbers. Okay,
yes.
Good. Yeah, because that would really facilitate private gifts.
$100
bucks. You actually get to write that off.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I don't know if you had mentioned the website. It's bowca.org.
Yes.
Great. Thanks again, Susan, for being here. We really appreciate what you're doing and your leadership in this. I know it takes a real passion and commitment to be part of a nonprofit. So
thank you.
Move it forward.
Thanks again, Susan. That moves us on to item 4, overview of the Scholastic Clay Target Program. And for a little bit of background, I was able to see a presentation by these folks about 3 or 4 months ago and was very impressed, and I had a feeling that the commissioners would be impressed, and I asked them to come out for this. We have David Turner, Richard Lynch, and Lieutenant John Winings from the department involved, and we'd like to hear from them.
Thank you very much, Madam President and Commissioners. My name is Richard Lynch, and I'm delighted to be here today. I want to thank John Winings and the support back there with Dave Tanner and my wife, Kathleen, all involved in the Scholastic Clay Target Program. It's my understanding that my mission here today is to give you some information that you may be seeking. And I don't know exactly what that is, so I'm going to make just a very few remarks to cover the genesis of the program, and then I would invite you to fill in the gaps as you see fit by asking any questions. I've been involved in the program since 2002, and it has given me nothing but huge emotional rewards, and I think I speak for almost everyone else in there. The program itself began in 2001. It was a partnership between the National Shooting Sports Foundation, and it was a brainchild of Dr. Bill Christie, who was a trap and skeet coach at Virginia Tech University. He was instrumental in developing the shooting sports program for the 4-H on a national basis, and partly in response to a drop-off in participation in competitive shotgun sports, the National Shooting Sports Foundation tried to brainstorm a way to reverse that trend. And they partnered with Dr. Christie, and they came up with the Scholastic Clay Target Program. It originally started with just trap shooting, and the first year so much exceeded their expectations that before that first year was over, the skeet and the sporting clays people were all over them to ask if they could be involved. And since that time, it's had phenomenal growth. We're in over 35 states, and about 15,000 young athletes participate. One of the great things about this is that we take youth through high school, and gender has absolutely no bearing on the success of an individual in the program. So we have, in our program, about 25% of the athletes in our program are young ladies, and they're very successful at it. Part of the success of this program is that we started it as a youth development program, which just happens to use the clay target sports as its modality. And we have that mission of being a youth development program in the very first paragraph of our annual handbook. And we've never lost sight of that fact. And I think that speaks to why this program has succeeded where a lot of other youth programs, which may not be guided by such good ideals, have fallen away. We have, with apologies, the Little League system. I was in it myself, and it's a great system, but we've been able to avoid the stereotypical Little League parent crisis that you sometimes see. We demand that all of the coaches and adult volunteers in our program become certified. And Lieutenant Winings, Dave Tanner, my wife back there, and I personify that. We have all gone through a minimum of a two-day coach training course. It certainly involves tactics and techniques for shotgun shooting in a competitive situation, but it's about coaching too and about our mission. One of the cool things about it is that we attract so many kids that come from non-shooting families, and that was unexpected. It's a great byproduct of it. Our start at our local club in Amador County was in 2002, and we brainstormed with our daughter, who wanted to help start this program. How many kids do you think, how many do you know that might be interested in this? And we thought there might be a dozen. So we conjured up a sign-up night at the local pizza parlor. We had over 60 kids show up, just curious about the program. We ended up signing and going through the season with 20 of them. The next year we went to 40. The next year we went to 80. And ever since then, we have had no fewer than 80. And this year we have more than 100 kids in our program, little old rural Amador County. It's a situation where almost every club that starts a team experiences the same thing. You have to be careful what you hope for, because they start with 15 this year, and next year they don't know where to put them all. If the Fish and Game Commission of California is interested in this, we stand more than ready to answer any questions and to partner in some way. We don't come to you asking for money. We come to you saying that we think this is a great program. We think that it is a vehicle to introduce kids to competitive clay target sports, and we believe that's a gateway to all other good things that you may be interested in. So with that very sketchy introduction, I'll open it up to questions, and I would ask Dave Tanner to come up here and share with me, because he can testify to some of the questions I'm sure you may have.
Great. Thank you. Commissioners, any questions or comments?
Well, I'm just, it's wonderful to have presented to us another really good program for accessing people who either in the sense of youth, haven't had an opportunity to, and they were young, and they're just developing their thoughts about how the outdoors work. And then with the other program, BOW, taking people who ordinarily wouldn't have thought to have become involved in the outdoors. These are really terrific programs, really important to us.
Yeah, they are, and there are some statistics to back that up. Lieutenant Winings has been in contact with a shooting sports coordinator for the state of Arizona, and they have gathered some data which will support the notion that people involved in the Scholastic Clay Target Program buy hunting and fishing licenses. Particular importance is that these are kids who would not ordinarily have been driven to buy a hunting or fishing license.
I think it probably, I'm just guessing this, but the kids' exposure to gentlemen such as yourselves probably teaches these kids to become stewards of the environment as well, which is a very important thing.
It certainly does. Again, my name is Dave Tanner from Valley Springs, California, and I brought a couple of pictures I'd like to share with you. First of all, to see, this is a picture of I'll pass it around. This is the sign-up day at Rich and Kathleen's event in Amador County. And there were 109 children who signed up for that season. One of them happened to be my daughter. I had started with the program also early with Rich, and out of Sacramento, I used to drive my son, David, from Valley Springs to Sacramento for practice, which is about an hour and 15-minute drive each way. And we went every week when the program first started. It was very rewarding. I think our first season we had about 700 kids in the sport, and I heard numbers now topping over 31,000 for this last year.
Wow.
And the children that are involved, it's amazing to me. I also included a picture of my son and daughter who are proof of what comes from this program. Both of my children, Katie and David, are my son now is a junior at in that picture he's about 15, but he's a junior at University of Pacific. He's studying to be a music teacher. And my daughter Katie, who's now a sophomore at Calaveras High School. Katie is tied for top in her class with a 4.26 grade point average. She's an advanced celloist. She plays piano. She's playing in accompanying a couple of musicals this next week. But one thing she loves more than anything is picking up a shotgun. And you can see by the look on her face, she likes to pheasant hunt too. We've watched some of the rewards from working with these kids. The fact that it's not a physical sport. It's a sport that they have to learn to focus and concentrate. They work diligently at this sport. Every week, sometimes it's twice a week, they're out there for the last 2 weeks in the rain, even working to practice with such desire to succeed. One of the things we've learned is that the kids have to learn also how to lose. Unfortunately, they will lose a lot. And as a parent, we see so many parents that are pushing their children only to succeed. And watching them come through this program, knowing that they're going to lose a lot, every once in a while they do win something. And when they do, they truly cherish it. We've put medals over the kids around their necks at these events and seen them the next day at school still wearing those medals with great pride. We do hold the children to, both Rich and I and most of the members hold the kids to a scholastic level of achievement as far as grades. We push them. We check their grades. We make sure that they do stay with the program and keep at least a 2.0 grade point average, which is consistent with scholastic levels. But we've watched a couple of children. I think that's more important. I've had five kids now that were failing in school. We would let them practice. They couldn't compete. But they worked hard. Now, one young gentleman who I'm quite proud of, who he's not alone, but a number of them, worked very, very hard and got his grades up to A's and B's, and I got kisses from the moms.
That's why you're in.
Absolutely. And it's funny I mentioned that, but one of the greatest thrills I think Rich and I have is we there's 109 kids in that picture, but with that 109 kids, there's always brothers and sisters, mom and dad, usually both sets of grandparents that come to the events. Angels Camp, I'll never forget, we had a host shoot up there where we filled the parking lot of the fairgrounds with cars for people that came to watch their children shoot. One time, even in the snow, we had about a foot of snow the day of the shoot, and they still came. And it's been their single most successful day of food and beverage service because they all have to eat. But our local gunsmith, say Rusty's Gunsmithing up in San Andreas, one day told me, he says, Dave, I've got 19 guns in my safe from your kids from this program. The fathers and the mothers who get involved and learn how to shoot. I was watching the women's shooting sport. We have quite a few mothers who volunteer their time and started off with a kind of a negative attitude against guns, against shooting, and have really gotten on board. They've seen how what this means to the children, how they get involved in it, and now they're out there even shooting it. Most of us belong to Comanche Hills Hunting Club. We do our pheasant shooting.
All right, I got to stop you because you're going to just keep on going.
Okay.
We get it. I have a couple questions for you. You're sitting at standing in front of a table full of wing shooters. So I'm curious on a couple things. How many of the kids end up getting hunting licenses? Do you have any idea?
We don't track that with hard figures. The state of Tennessee and the state of Arizona does track that. I can just give you some anecdotal evidence of that, that we have kids talking to us about their hunting experiences, for the first time hunting experiences, and we just know that some of those kids are from non-hunting families.
Right.
We would be happy to start tracking that, though, if you have a particular interest in it.
I find it, interesting. I think it's a good way to introduce young people not only into shooting but into hunting as well. And I saw both of your children up there, and I kind of chuckled when you said it was it wasn't physical. I'm thinking, I've done some pheasant hunting. I thought it was pretty physical, personally.
I was referring to the clay target shooting.
And so I have, exactly. But I saw your kids with the pheasants there. And I have mixed emotions because I think, great, they're trading all these great shots out there, and they're going to get those birds that I'm going to be missing. No, I think it's terrific. Yeah. And
now, Mr.
congratulations.
Richards, we have to say that in order to be true to our mission, we are going to remain a youth development program which uses competitive clay target sports as its modality. But the natural outfall from that, and we have a lot of partners are going to reap the benefits from that, and we know that's true. We're going to be more successful if people like Dave and I do what we do best, and that's to develop the youth around the core of shooting, and they're going to find their way to the other sports.
To go off of that, what you just said, that was what I actually personally viewed as the most important part of your program. We all know that we owe our children, and we really owe our children a sense of self-worth. And if this program functions the way it seems to function, you definitely are going to be engendering in these children a sense of self-worth, which is why that young man is getting A's and B's from failing grades. It's why your people probably are doing the best. Probably the best metric for your success is how well your kids do in school and in work and in their life after having gone through your course. I suspect that you have a substantial impact on the lives of those kids who participate in your program, and I really think you guys are doing a great job.
We absolutely do. That's the emotional rewards that keep us coming back. And at our level through high school, we have these kids have created a demand for collegiate shooting programs, and that is making the collegiate program grow faster. And we are actually a feeder system now for the USA shooting team. Two of the Olympic medalists in Beijing came out of the Scholastic Clay Target Program.
That's fantastic.
I've got to say this since you mentioned the collegiate part, because I'm sure that you know West Virginia University is the national rifle champions this year for about the 20th time.
He might be from West Virginia.
Yes.
Exactly, to give. I'd really like to thank both of you for being here today and sharing this with us. I understood you did have some video you were trying to get to us to share, and I'm wondering if you could...
Lieutenant Winings will be your source for that.
Okay.
And there is a website. There's a national website that the Scholastic Shooting Sports Foundation has, which is 3SF Online. And there is a website dedicated to the California trap portion of the SCTP, and that is CASCTPTRAP. So you can get more information there, and John has our literature, and
great.
He'll be our conduit for that.
Great.
And I'm going to authorize him to give you my contact information. I'm more than happy to take any questions at any time on this.
Great. Well, thank you again so much, and both for you and our previous speaker. I know I attended, Susan, this might be of interest as well. I attended the WAFA conference and the winter conference in San Francisco. We talked a lot about what Missouri had done with educating their population to support their fish and game or fish and wildlife department. And so much of it came from people that weren't traditional hunters or fishermen, and getting those environmental centers that they have in the major urban areas was a big push for them, because that's what we need to depend on. Those are the people we need to influence, and your efforts for both organizations are really demonstrating the success of those. So thank you.
Sure thing. Thank you.
Oh, and we're going to take a quick 5-minute break here, and we'll reconvene. Yeah. At 10 after 11. We'll get this meeting back underway. Thank you for indulging our break. Those
okay.
of you in the lobby, if you can lower your voices out there.
Where's Nancy when we need her?
Where's Nancy at?
Yeah, she took off. We lost Nancy. Okay. Yeah. Sergeants at arms are all gone. They're probably taking pictures in the parking lot. We're going to get started on item number 5, receipt of public testimony on proposed changes to Subsection B 91.1 of Section 7.50, Title 14, CCR, related to Klamath Trinity Salmon Fishing Regulations. Please note that additional public testimony is scheduled for the Commission's April 9, 2009 meeting. From the Department, everybody's pointing at everybody. Okay. Larry Hansen.
John, real quick, the department has a quick question. The next three agenda items are all fundamentally connected, and so we had a question. Would you like the department to run through its presentations involving the Klamath of the Central Valley and the ocean, and then take discussion or treat them independently?
Well, we have very few speaker cards, so to make it the cleanest for our regulatory program, the speakers are going to have to be very clear on what they're speaking on.
Okay.
So we've only got two speaker cards right now. So to me...
So we'll deal...
I mean, you guys could go ahead and give all your presentation, but then the speakers will have to be specific on what they're talking about.
All right.
I guess, Cindy, do you have a feel on that?
Yeah, I think we can handle it that way.
Go ahead and give the full presentation, and then we'll have let people speak, and they can talk specifically about those items.
Madam President, Commissioners, good morning. My name is Larry Hansen. I'm a Senior Biologist Supervisor with the Klamath Trinity Program for the Department. I'm here today to discuss the 2009 regulation packet, the ISOR, that's been...
And Larry, just a second here. So if we are going to go through the three, I should read them all into the record then.
Okay.
So it would be, I've already read Klamath Trinity. This was also a presentation on receipt of public testimony of proposed changes to Section 7.00 and 7.50, Title 14, CCR, related to Central Valley Salmon Fishing Regulations. Please note, additional public testimony is scheduled for the Commission's April 9th meeting. And then we also will be receiving public testimony on proposed changes to Section 2780, Title 14, CCR, related to Ocean Salmon Fishing Regulations. And that additional public testimony will be scheduled for the Commission's April 9th meeting on that also. Go ahead, Larry.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson.
As I said,
I'm here to talk to you about the packet that I submitted for your consideration in February regarding the Klamath Trinity regulations for 2009. Basically, as we do every year prior to the PFMC allocations for this fishery, the ISOR contains essentially a lot of placeholders with a range of options for your consideration down the road once we do get the final allocation from the council. So in that vein, I have set aside a range of the total sport fishing allocation between 0 and 40,000. I realize that's a rather large number. However, last year we kind of got caught shortchanged by the ISOR and I had to renotice, so I made that large. I proposed for your consideration a possession limit between 0 and 9 Chinook salmon, and of those, a range of 0 to 6 adults, with a daily bag range of 0 to 4 Chinook salmon, of which 0 to 3 may be adults. For your consideration, I've also included two changes, and then a bunch of language cleanup, basically, within the package. The first change that I proposed is the extension of the wild trout fishing section of the Upper Trinity, which exists below Lewiston Dam to the old Lewiston Bridge. This fishery is a catch-and-release artificials-only fishery. It is open from early April through August 31st currently. And basically what happens every year within the hydrograph is there is what's called the record of decision flows, the rod flows. As soon as the season opens up, they open up the dams, and for fisheries restoration purposes, the fishery becomes unfishable due to high flows for anywhere from April till mid-July. So those folks have lost a lot of opportunity. What we've done is tack an extra 15 days of the season from September 1st through the second week of September through September 15th to allow fishing opportunity with little, if any, impacts on the salmon resource that would be in that area. The second change would be the spit area in the lower river. So now we've gone from the headwaters down to the ocean. In the past regulation packages, the spit fishery, which is a highly emotionally charged issue down in that lower river, has been the limiting factor on the threshold on the closure of that fishery has been 15% of the total in-river sport fishing quota. I propose to change that to 15% of the lower river quota. The lower river is allocated 50% of the sport allocation. This measure is intended to prevent a runaway fishery and overharvest in that section of the river, especially when the mouth is on the south end of the spit. So I thought that this would be a conservation measure appropriate, and I have a lot of support on that change. Also, within the packet, I removed the hook and weight restrictions that have been in the packet in the past. It's covered under Chapter 2, Article 1, Section 210 of the General Freshwater Fishing Regulations, and to me that appears to be pretty redundant in the Klamath package. Also, for general information purposes and for ease of reading the regulations, and at the suggestion of our AOL staff, the numeric quotas for each of the four subsections will now be included in the regulation table so individuals can see what the quota for the particular reach of the river is, and the daily bag and possession limits on the exempted fisheries in the region of the Iron Gate Hatchery and Trinity River Hatchery fisheries are also listed on the regulation table. So that's all I have for you right now, and I guess we can segue into Scott Barrow. I'll be available for any questions now, and I'll be close for any questions later.
Commissioners, any questions, or should we move forward and come back to questions? Okay. Thank you.
Actually, it's Neil Manji, Fisheries Branch. Scott Barrow will be presenting right after me. I just wanted to give the – no, it's going to be 1 minute – give the commission a brief update on the Sacramento River late fall run fishery that you guys – that the commission had approved last year. Trying to carve out – you remember I was in front of you trying to carve out a fishery. Well, I'd like to give the commission an update of what occurred. It was a very successful fishery. We had about 2,500 fish caught during that period of time. We there were approximately 90,000 angler hours and 16,000 angler trips. So I think it went very, very well. Based on coated wire tags, we saw only one winter run Chinook taken in terms of coated wire tags, and late fall run fish were basically the remainder of the catch. There is going to be some concerns brought forward later on in this process regarding that fishery and whether they did have impacts to fall run fishery. At this time, we're still looking at that, but I just thought it would be a good idea to start off with the Central Valley that it went good and provided a lot of angling effort and a lot of happy anglers out there. Now I'll introduce Scott Barrow, who's on my staff as a senior biologist specialist. He'll go over the Central Valley angling regulation options and also the ocean fishery options. Scott.
Good morning, Commissioners. Scott Barrow with the department. Can I get the presentation queued up that says 6 and 7? Yes. So I'll first speak to you about the Central Valley salmon options that we have available in your packet for this year. First of all, I'll give you some information on how the Sacramento Fall Chinook ended up last year. Basically, the escapement for natural and hatchery adult was 66,264. If you recall, last year we're shooting for 122,000 to 180,000. As you say, as you see, we made about 54% of that. The escapement for jacks, which we use to project on abundance for this year, is 4,061. It's the second lowest on record, last year being the first lowest. And then we're using a new index called the Sacramento Index, which deals with all the Sacramento Falls Chinook abundance in the ocean. That projection for this year using those jacks, using linear regression, shows up about 122,196. So it gives us about 196 fish above and beyond the lower level of the FMP objective. And then the last two items are, the PFMC salmon technical team goes ahead and projects the abundance using regulations from 08 and 07. And under 08 regulations, we'll have about 100 fish over the minimum level. And using the 07 regulations, we'll be about less, just like last year, if we had a season like was structured in 07. Basically, overall proposals, three options. We do these for public notices purposes, trying to address benchmark or bracket what comes out of the PFMC. All options this year will apply to anadromous waters within the district and special regulations. And we're not going to allow any catch and release fishing for salmon this year under a zero bag limit. And these are structured to allow continued harvest on all the non-salmonid species. Basically, first option is everything is going to be closed this year. All the waters in blue will be closed. Basically, it'll say closed to salmon fishing and no take or possession of salmon. That's a requirement enforcement wanted to put in. Basically, we're going to allow you to hunt, pursue, capture, catch, or kill, or attempt to do so. That's why we're trying to initiate this new process. The bag limits for trout and steelhead will still stay the same. Option one is everything closed. Option two is allowing some possibility of a season if it comes out of the PFMC, if we're allowed to allow it to happen in either the Sacramento River, the Feather River, or the American River. So again, that scope is intentionally broad to allow flexibility in the final season. And again, all other anadromous waters will be closed. Option three is just some combination of option one and two, just trying to capture everything. So this is the end of the Central Valley presentation. I'll stop for questions or continue on with the ocean.
Any questions, commissioners? Okay. Continue on.
Ocean options. In addition to the Central Sacramento Fall Chinook abundance, we have the Klamath River Fall Chinook abundance. It came in at 30,900 fish last year. The objective was 40,700. We didn't meet what they call the floor. The preseason abundance is 505,700. Of that, 94% of them are age 3 fish, and 5% of them are age 4 fish, which is the lowest since 85, since the lowest on record since 85 in 2008. And again, using a benchmark, looking at over 8 regulations, for Klamath only, we'll end up with about 51,800 coming back to natural spawners. That's the guideline. And under 07 regulations, we'll be at 41,800. And again, Sacramento, it's a combination of both abundances. So you see Sacramento's still going to be limiting this year. Basically, same thing. Zero, nothing closed, or some opportunity that may be crafted from all the things that happen at the PFMC. So basically, where are we at after this meeting? We'll have the PFMC March ocean fishery options that come out. I'm also told that there's a report coming out of NIMS on the decline of the Sacramento River Fall Chinook. It's supposed to be out at the April meeting. It got delayed a little bit. And then, we have our April commission meeting, and then we have NIMS guidance on Central Valley abundance. At that point, I'll get off the podium.
Okay. Questions, commissioners?
Thanks.
Commissioner Sutton?
Thanks very much for that. I had also heard about this report that's coming out that the council is going to receive on the causes of the collapse of the Sacramento River Fall Chinook. We'd love to get a copy of that. Can you make sure, or somebody make sure that we get that? Is that something of concern to all of us?
Any other commissioner questions? Okay, we have one public speaker on this item, and that's Bob Buki. Did I get it right? Okay.
I would just like to I'm Bob Buki from Johnson's Bait and Tackle in Yuba City, and I'm in support of the option 2 that we get some limited salmon fishing. It sounds like there might be a little bit that could be given out. I would not like to see more than one fish allowed. And my concern about no take and no possession of salmon, to me, doesn't say you can't target salmon and catch and release. I'd like something more stated in there that says no targeting of salmon, or a little more that's clearer to the public and to the game wardens. So thank you very much.
Go ahead.
Is this working? Okay, before you go farther here, he is speaking on Central Valley salmon. Is that correct,
correct,
Mr. Buki? Okay, so his comments were on Central Valley salmon. I don't believe that we have any comments at all, commissioners submitted or speakers submitted comments on ocean salmon or Klamath Trinity salmon at this point in time. And I don't know if you want to clarify on the bag limit item or not.
Sure. Does the department have any response on that? Scott?
Yes. This is going to take education to the public. Basically, no take means you can't harass them, can't look at them, can't even try for them. This is a measure that enforcement, we felt that closed for salmon fishing was adequate enough to tell them you can't go for it. Enforcement wanted this additional measures to go ahead and get them not to try it. I mean, we're going to have to take education to educate the public this year that you can't try, you can't even be out there trying for them under the guise of something else. We're going to be working really hard to make sure that what happened last year is not even possible this year.
Okay. But I'm just saying that I don't believe that no take is going to...
Knowing my people, I deal with all the fishermen all the time, and no take doesn't mean no catch and release. It just means you can't take one home with you. And I think something needs to be put in there that clarifies
some better
that
public
more.
Education. Right. Thank you. I think it's an excellent point. And I actually had a question for the department. I know in the past when we've had changes in language or issues, especially maybe on the more relevant to the Trinity and Klamath area, what kind of public outreach or what kind of constituent groups have you worked with on that so that they're sure, we're sure they understand the changes in the language and the issues that you've worked with? It sounds like you have worked with them. Maybe you could describe that to us.
Yes, Larry Hansen again, Department of Fish and Game.
I make the circuit through the county board of supervisors and the fish and game advisory commissions of the county, and usually I do a wrap-up of what happened the season before informationally and what we are proposing as far as regulations for the forthcoming season.
Yes.
I have a couple questions. What were the problems that you're referring to that occurred last year you don't want to see occur this year? And not only what were the problems, but what was the depth of those problems?
Neil Manchi again. After being on a couple Bob Sims shows and SEP shows, things like that, on the radio, it was very clear that the anglers were quite upset that we were allowing fishing on top of these salmon, and that the regulations currently state that we have a zero bag limit. And under a zero bag limit, that allows for catch and release. If you look at a lot of the trout regulations where we have catch and release fisheries, it says zero bag limit. In years ago, we used to have areas that were closed to salmon fishing, and that was very clear. So after talking with the public and talking with our wildlife protection, we said, "What can we go back to that?" And they said they're fine with going back to language that it's closed to salmon fishing, but also you have to say and to the take of salmon. And what we're going to do is most likely in the supplement add that definition of what take is, which means to pursue. So if you're out there in your boat pursuing salmon, that it will be against law. Now, we heard a lot of individuals stating that this is an outrage. We've got a lot of people out there targeting salmon, catch and release. I had our Central Valley Creel Survey make sure to go to every known salmon hole up along this area where it's closed to get good notes. And there were about three different areas that are classic, mouth of feather, below the thermalio outlet at on the feather, and also on the American River at the basin there. And we looked and we did some education. But in general, there weren't a lot of other, you know, $40,000-$50,000 guide boats out there back trolling, saying they're fishing for steelhead. That was not an issue. And I made it very clear to most of the creelers to go out there and tell them, you know, I know the fishery, I know the area, and if they're out there doing certain things, make sure to let them know that they're not fooling anybody. And from that, we have some pretty good direct observations that was not occurring other than three areas. And what we said in our regulations, and I think the commission also in that news release stated that if the department finds that there's a lot of individuals out there that are targeting these fish for catch and release, that we would come back in front of the commission and ask for emergency regulation to shut these things down completely. And we didn't want to do that because you have all these other fisheries that occur, trout, striped bass, shad, things like that. So it was a perceived problem, but in reality, it wasn't a huge problem just in certain areas. And now we're trying to make sure the public realizes that it is closed for salmon, because some of the public still felt that they could catch and release legally. They weren't being criminals, but the idea is when they read in the regulation where it says closed to salmon fishing, I think it's going to be fairly clear.
And does it make sense to have in the regulation no catch and release? To actually say it in black and white so that it doesn't confuse people? I mean, why couldn't we?
We'll have to talk with protection on that, no catch and release, because you're out there fishing and you actually catch one, you know.
Well, I'm not saying that would be the only thing you'd say in there. I'm saying that would be part of the thing. I like the pursue and all of that. I think that was
We could talk to the wardens and see whether, and our legal, see where that puts us in terms of no catch and release. It's, if we write that in there and an individual actually catches a fish, a salmon, when he's, or the person steelhead fishing and releases it, would that person actually be in violation? So it is an educational thing. And we could come back, and at the next meeting we'll give you a little bit better explanation.
Okay. And I have another question, if I may. What is the penalty? If a warden caught someone pursuing the salmon and catching them, what is the penalty? What do we charge them with, and what is the penalty?
obviously a misdemeanor, but I'm not sure.
It's a misdemeanor.
Come on up, John. No, I guess we lost Nancy.
I believe it's an infraction, a misdemeanor. It's a wobblet, so it can be charged either infraction or misdemeanor. And I believe most of the base fines are running $200-$300, somewhere around there. So it depends on the court, and the court can do.
Yeah, of course. I'm just wanting to know what we have on the statutes, what the courts do, or often.
Does that answer your question?
Yes. Thank you.
For the record, that was Lieutenant John Winings.
Any other questions, comments, commissioners? Okay. Thank you. And thanks for your public input. We appreciate your suggestions on that.
We can move to item number 8, receipt of public testimony on tag quota changes, clarifications, and urgency changes for the 2009-2010 mammal hunting regulations. Please note additional public testimony is scheduled for the Commission's April 9th meeting. Dr. Eric Loft.
Good morning, President Gustafson, Commissioners. Eric Loft with the Wildlife Branch, and again, I'm coming back to provide you a brief update on the mammal reg process. And currently what we have underway in front of you is revision of Section 353, and I'll remind folks that 353 last year was the big one for us as it related to lead and restriction on lead ammunition in the Condor Range. And there is some misconception out there that I know Commission staff is hearing, as well as the Department's hearing, that we're entertaining something right now as it relates to lead, and there is no proposal being put forward right now that deals with lead. So that's not on the table right now as far as any of the current proposals and recommendation. But we are in 353 looking at, in particular, method of take related to muzzle loaders, and we have, based on the meeting last month, come back with a second option. The first option for dealing with the muzzle loaders and the visually impaired folks was that we would issue upon application anybody who was a muzzle loader hunting the option to use a one power scope. We've come back based on your meeting last month with a new option that would require those muzzleloader hunters to apply for it and meet some sort of certification involving doctor's signature and some sort of authorization to obtain a one-power authority for a one-power scope. So that's what we would propose to do with the muzzleloader issue there, those two options. And certainly next year, big year with 2010, the big major regulation changes. There are other options that could be considered, such as do we even bother with this kind of a special late season hunt in the future, or do we open it up and let anybody who wants to hunt a late season special hunt? Those are some various options that I know folks have talked about that could be placed on the table for 2010. Other changes we're talking about for elk, we're proposing to allocate one of the two Grizzly Island tag fundraising tag elk and make it a special fundraising opportunity that would be usable in any of five zones. One of the zones is La Panza area down by San Luis Obispo. The other four are Northern California, and that would give that fundraising tag holder the opportunity, I believe, to hunt for either Tule elk, Roosevelt elk, or Rocky Mountain elk. Is that right, John? Thanks. Checking with our old elk coordinator to make sure I got that right. So thank you. Related to black bear hunting, I guess I could have asked Cook. Mr. Cook, the boss, sorry. Sure. Excuse me. related to black bear, and these are just some of the more substantial changes that we're talking about for mammal regs, and that's all I'm covering. For black bear, we propose to this year include San Luis Obispo County in the hunt zone for black bear. That's based on a recommendation made to you almost 2 years ago and follows on 2 years of data collection by the department that it is justified, and the population of bears there is doing quite well and could support a hunt there. And so we're pushing ahead on that. And then finally, we're proposing to eliminate the required notification of all bear hunters when we've achieved, back in our office,
a tally of 1,700 dead bears through hunting. Typically, that happens about 3 days before the season ends, and what the current regulation requires is us to send in through the mail a notification to every bear hunter saying the season's closed, and they'll get it the day after the season has really closed anyway. So it's to us it's an unnecessary thing. The bear population's thriving in California, as I'm sure President Gustafson knows, in the Tahoe area. And they're doing quite well. And we're trying to expand in San Luis Obispo County, so there's no issue related to the bear population, in our opinion. And it will also save several thousand dollars by eliminating this requirement. So that's all I had on, I think, on the mammal regs. I know Sonke had brought up last time. I don't know if it were a couple of changes that were related to licenses. I don't know if we need to bring those up. Okay. I think those were minor.
Okay. Commissioners, do you have any questions?
Do we have any speaker comments?
Yeah, we have two speakers.
I will after the speaker.
Okay. Then we'll go ahead to public comment.
Bill Gaines and Walt Manzel.
Morning, Commissioners, President Gustafson, and members of the department staff. My name is Bill Gaines. I'm president of the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance. And I'm pleased today, on behalf of the California Houndsmen for Conservation and some of our other members, to offer our complete support of the proposal by the department to open up bear hunting in San Luis Obispo County, as well as the elimination of the notification letter, which will save the department a substantial amount of money each year and also will provide some certainty for hunters and for enforcement as to when the season will actually end on bears, instead of a floating season that depends on just how the bear hunting has been going on throughout the season and when the quota is being approached. So we're pleased to support both of those changes that are being proposed, and we urge your support as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Walt Manzel? So everything's copacetic. That's good.
Thanks, Walt. In our packet, and I'm going to try to do this each meeting, is draw your attention to, we did receive one public comment on this that came after our packet. So if you haven't had a chance, you might want to read that relative to the bear hunt in San Luis Obispo County. Okay, Commissioner Rogers.
Yeah, I wanted to, where are you, Eric? I wanted to emphasize my feelings that I didn't really express much the last time we talked about this. About scopes on muzzleloaders. I believe that that's a significant enforcement problem. And once these things come around, will we have an absolutely clear option to be able to not allow scopes on muzzleloaders? Because I don't understand why a guy can't, I know we don't allow them now, but I want to make certain that has really been vetted out and we have in front of us all the information that we need to make that, to, I guess, a no-change decision.
I think in this case, at least as I understand it, part of it would rely on whether it really is an ADA issue.
Well, that remains to be proven in court, I think.
Right.
You know, I think somebody can wear glasses or they can wear contact lenses. A scope, to me, is an enforcement problem that is of significance. That would mean that the warden would have to walk up to every single person that has a scope, get the papers, if we're requiring papers, determine that it was a one-power scope. This is an enforcement nightmare.
I think also you have that option of taking that on and saying no scopes. The original intent of these hunts was it was a primitive style hunt. It was not supposed to benefit from modern technology.
Well, of course, we know that modern muzzleloaders are not exactly primitive pieces.
Exactly. Well, see, it's already been modernized from original intent. So that actually begs the question of is, if we're going to do that, why do we just limit it to the guys that have muzzleloaders?
And that's the exact point, and I have the same feeling Richard has on this. Typically, I'd be pretty much pro-shooters and hunters, et cetera, but I'm really confused on why we would even consider that, given the special privilege we already give muzzleloaders. It seems to me inappropriate, and it will go to the next step of getting rid of the special hunt for them, which I think probably isn't exactly what they'd like to see come out of that. I get the threat of lawsuits and all that, and I'm speaking certainly on my part, but I think most of our commission is pretty much committed to this. We're not going to – a threat is a threat. Great, threaten us, do whatever. And if it's proven in court you got to do something different, then we'll, of course, abide by that. But that's certainly not a reason for us to make that change, in my opinion anyway.
Yeah, and from our perspective, we're trying to be as equitable as we can, and these guys get quite a good deal. Yeah, yeah. So.
Commissioner Sutton?
I'd just like to associate myself with the comments of my fellow commissioners on this issue. As a former warden, the enforceability issue alone strikes me as dispositive here.
Very good.
Well, I think we're all four on record that. Sankey?
Yeah, just a quick recap. The reason for us putting this option before you is a request at how could we accommodate visually impaired hunters in this venue. And this is the only thing we could come up with short of abandoning the special privilege. It's certainly your option.
Okay. I don't think it's a solution. You're just getting much support.
I hear you.
Okay. But thanks for your effort to try to address it. Okay. I think now we're going to move on.
To number 10?
Yeah. Number 9, right?
Number 9.
To item number 9. Yeah. And then we're going to plan to take our lunch break. An exec session for about 2 hours, starting at the conclusion of item 9 and 10. We're going to try to get through both. Is that correct?
No.
Just 9?
10's pretty straightforward, too.
Yeah. So we're going to try to do both of these items and try to get through this before our lunch break, and then we'll conclude with about a two-hour exec session and lunch break. So for those of you there, we're going to try to push these through relatively quickly.
And Madam President, for the record, for item number 9, due to my earlier recusal, I have to leave the dais.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Rogers. Okay.
Pursuant to Fish and Game Code Sections 2075, 2075.5, consideration and possible action on the petition and the department's one-year status report / recommendation on the petition to list the longfin smelt and adoption of commission findings. Chief Deputy Director John McCammon has some comments, and we have two public speaker cards.
Madam President, this is the commission's final substantive step in the long and sometimes contentious process that's leading to the regarding longfin smelt beginning August 2007. Today you will consider whether or not to list longfin smelt as a threatened species under the California Endangered Species Act. The recommended action by the department comes after a year-long status review of the species in which the department documented serious population declines, a variety of significant ongoing threats, and recommended management actions for this species. According to the species review, the status review, longfin's population has plummeted from the tens of millions in 1982 to the tens of thousands, several magnitudes of scale by 2007. At your last meeting, you heard a detailed report of the department's conclusions regarding longfin presented by Marty Gringris, a departmental biologist. He is here. Since that time, the department has received comments both for and against the listing. After detailed review of these comments, none of the comments have changed the department's recommendation to the commission to list the species. Also, since the last meeting, a few other important events have occurred concerning longfin. The emergency take order, the 2084 order that you've adopted three times over the past year, expired on February 23rd. That same day, the department issued an incidental take permit pursuant to 2081 for the Department of Water Resources' continued operation of the pumps in the San Joaquin Delta. With attachments, this 150-page permit specifies flow restrictions based on triggers like those similar to those used in the 2084 and habitat restoration measures to minimize and fully mitigate the impact of the pumps over the next 10 years. Well before this time, the 10-year permit period, all parties anticipate that the Bay Delta Conservation Plan being developed pursuant to the Natural Communities Conservation Plan Act will be in place to authorize the continued operation of the pumps and many other Delta-related activities for the full suite of Delta species, not just for longfin. Marty Gringer's from the Bay Delta Division, and Ann Malcolm, our general counsel, are here to answer specific questions raised by the commission or members of the public who may be here to testify on this item. And the department recommends you accept its recommendation to list longfin smelt as threatened at this time.
Okay, question? Commissioner Sutton?
Thank you, John. Before we have public comment, I appreciate the department's recommendation and its findings here. The only question I came away from reading the status review was, why aren't we recommending this for listing as endangered? I mean, we just had to uplist the Delta smelt to endangered from threatened. I realize it's a different species with somewhat different life history, but it seems to me that history is repeating itself here, and we'll find ourselves uplisting this one, too, in short order. So why don't we just do it now?
The short answer is the determination that was made during the status review that it's not an imminent threat of extinction, which is the definition for endangered. So the lesser protection, and in fact, the protections provided under both threatened and endangered are the same protections. So it's not, we couldn't show that it was an imminent threat of extinction, and but it was threatened in the long term.
I'm just trying to save you some time from having to uplist it again. So,
other questions, commissioners? Okay. Do we want to go to public?
Yes.
Speakers.
We have public comment. Gary Bobker, followed by Daniel O'Hanlon.
Thank you, Madam President, members of the Commission and staff, members of the Department. Hi, Don. My name is Gary Bobker. I'm the Program Director at the Bay Institute, one of the petitioners to list longfin. My message to you is very brief. First of all, it's thank you for providing interim protections for the species during the period of candidacy. We think that the Department of Fish and Game has made a compelling case that the population of longfin smelt is at serious risk of extinction and has been in precipitous decline over a long period. And we urge you to take the final step and list longfin under the California Endangered Species Act. Mr. Sutton, I personally agree, and the petitioners would agree, that longfin does merit endangered status. We understand that the difference between, say, a two-year life cycle and a one-year cycle, like with Delta smelt, you know, may give you a relative sense of the risk, but nonetheless, we think it merits it. But the most important thing is to list this fish and to fully protect it. So we're focusing on just let's get the fish listed. Thank you.
God. Daniel O'Hanlon.
Thank you. Good morning. Madam President and members of the Commission. I'm Daniel O'Hanlon. I'm an attorney from Sacramento, California. I represent the state water contractors who are members of 27 public agencies that contract for water supply from the Department of Water Resources from the State Water Project. I'm also here today on behalf of the San Luis and Delta Mendota Water Authority, a joint powers authority that represents 31 public agencies that contract with the Bureau of Reclamation for Water Supply from the Central Valley Project. Together, these projects provide 25 million Californians with at least a portion of their water supply and supply water to over 2 million acres of farmland in California. Before I begin with my substantive comments, I'd like to welcome you to Yolo County. This is where I make my residence, and I appreciate the Commission holding its meeting here. I have two points I'd like to make this morning. I also have written comments that I'd like to submit after the conclusion of my comments. My comments are these. First, whether the Commission decides to list this species today turns on what range it considers, what portion of the longfin smelt's range the Commission will consider. If it considers the full actual range of the species, which ranges up to Alaska, there's no basis for finding that this species is actually threatened with extinction. The petition to list and the department's report are based on the Bay Delta population. There's no question that the Bay Delta population appears to have declined. But my point is that the Commission is making a choice today a choice that isn't compelled by law. And it's a discretionary choice, and it's a choice that's going to have significant environmental consequences within the service areas of the Central Valley Project and the State Water Project. The second point I'd like to make has to do with the costs and benefits of a listing decision today. Once the species is listed, regulation of effects on that species is largely out of the hands of the Commission. It then becomes the responsibility of the Department of Fish and Game. So far, the response from the Department has been largely to focus, and almost exclusively, on regulation of the State Water Project and the Central Valley Project. And that, unfortunately, is part of a broader orthodoxy about the impacts of the projects on species. But we have looked at the data, our consultants have looked at the data, and we don't see that project operations have a major effect on this species. Yes, they do entrain longfin smelt at the project pumps, but that entrainment is of a negligible percentage of the overall population within the Bay Delta. There's also assertions in the report about impacts to habitat, but there isn't the data to back up the assertion that significant changes to project operations are necessary or will benefit this species. So we don't see that there's going to be significant cost to water supply impacts if they occur. We don't think there's going to be a benefit. We don't think the data supports that assertion. And unfortunately, we do not have confidence that the regulation that's going to be imposed on the project will be proportionate to that impact. In conclusion, I regret to say this is an unfortunately bad time for this type of a regulation with a high cost to the people and the economy of California that we do not believe ultimately is going to result in benefit to this species. Thank you for considering my comments.
Thank you, Mr. O'Hanlon. Do we have any other public speakers on this? Okay, commissioners, any questions, comments? I had a couple. First off, I think, Mr. O'Hanlon, you made a couple of comments relative to our responsibility legally, and I'd like either our attorney or the department's attorney or somebody from the department to respond to that, because I think it's a very critical issue that you raised, whether or not we can consider what's going on in other states under the California Endangered Species Act. And I think it's been made very clear to us through legal advice that we need to consider what is happening in California. But
thank you, Madam Chair. I think it would be helpful to hear from the department's chief counsel, since the Attorney General's office was recused from representing any of the state agencies during the recent preliminary injunction action that occurred. So perhaps Ms. Malcolm would be best to speak to that. But I will say as a predicate matter that the AG's office advice, to my knowledge, has not changed, that it is out of the realm of the Commission's discretion to consider populations out of the state, and the Commission and the Department have the discretion to ascertain what is the appropriate unit of population that you wish to consider in making these decisions.
Ann Malcolm, the Department of Fish and Game's General Counsel. Good morning. We agree with the Attorney General's office. We talked about this back in February, where we brought before you language from what was then a recent Third District Court of Appeal decision called the California Forestry Association versus the California Fish and Game Commission that looked at coho salmon. And in that case, it made it very clear, and I'll just quote to you a few things from that case, that what the commission was supposed to consider at the time it was looking at listings were species populations in California. Now, you do have discretion when you're looking at significant portions of its range to see what area, what sort of subunit of that you want to consider. But for the most part, it is outside your discretion to look at populations outside of California, these Alaska populations, and use that as the basis for your decision. The court actually looked at a couple of things. It looked at your sort of long-standing practice about how you treated in-state and out-of-state populations. It looked at the language of the statute and several other things, and it ultimately concluded that CESA's focus is protecting species within the state, which is the extent of the state's regulatory authority. In enacting CESA, the legislature declared that endangered and threatened species were of value to the people of this state, and the conservation, protection, and enhancement of those species and their habitat is of statewide concern.
interpreting the range population to limit the inquiry to a species' likelihood of extinction in California furthers this legislative policy of protecting these species and their habitat for the value of Californians. And so it was a very clear determination that the court made, and that's the reason for our recommendation and the basis, I believe, for the recommendation of the Attorney General's office. One other comment I might make as one commissioner, unless there's other commissioners who have comments, is that I do agree entirely with the magnitude of what this issue means to the people of California. We all depend on water, and the impacts to this water delivery system through this process are of a huge magnitude. I don't think any of us can begin to quantify it, the full impacts. I think it's very important that the department, I know you're hearing us, but that those that we do everything we can to make those findings on the proportionate causes and look at all the impacts that we can identify. I hear this over and over from people in my industry and in other areas of the state that are so concerned with, don't just pick on the water delivery system. Let's look at all the causes of the decline of the species and what we can do to best protect it. So I know when you come back to us, we'll have a good discussion on whether those are, in fact, the best ways to go about it. And I think that, you know, as one commissioner also, I'd like to say that, you know, we find ourselves in this bind. People look at to us and assume that through this process that somehow we're God and that we have that ability to make these determinations. Is it better to protect people or fish? And I don't think that's the situation we're in here today. I mean, we certainly understand that this species is threatened, that we've seen a significant decline. And under the laws under which we serve here and we are sworn to office under, we must do take those steps mandated on us to protect those species. So it is not an easy decision to make. It certainly has profound impacts, but those are the laws under which we operate. So, Commissioner Richards, did you have a comment? Okay. Do we have a motion then from commissioners?
I have a suggestion. Okay. There's some technical language I want to add to the suggested motion, if that's okay.
Okay.
Maybe. Add away.
Maybe. We'll see.
Yes, it's suggested. The Fish and Game Commission, pursuant to the provisions of Section 2075 and 2075.5 of the Fish and Game Code, and to implement, interpret, or make specific said section of said code, hereby finds that the information contained in the petition to list the longfin smelt to the threatened or endangered species status warrants listing, and further to adopt slash ratify findings at the next meeting and publish notice of proposed rulemaking pursuant to Government Code 11346.4.
So moved.
Do I have a second?
I'll second.
Okay, any discussion? Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
I'm sorry, John. Should we not have voted?
I was going to ask if you want to specify threatened or endangered status.
I thought that the motion read threatened.
It says threatened or endangered, but we'll go. Oh, if you wanted to clarify that the motion
Shall
is threatened.
Shall we clarify that, please?
Absolutely threatened.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
My second is anyway.
Thank
okay,
you.
Okay, so that's amended to make it clear and unthreatened. Okay? I see some confusion at the department's table. Okay, take another vote, make sure it's clear. So I understand the motion maker has clarified his motion to indicate threatened. Is that correct?
List the longfin smelt as a threatened species.
Okay, and the second agrees with that.
Absolutely.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you.
Item 10, 10A, consideration and possible adoption ratifications of findings on the petition to uplist the Delta smelt to endangered species status. 10B, consideration and possible adoption of proposed changes to Section 670.5, Title 14 CCR to uplist the Delta smelt from the threatened to endangered species status. John McCammon.
I don't think I was listed on this one, but this is the last step. Or do you have this, Ann?
Sure.
Okay.
Ann Malcolm, Fish and Game's General Counsel. As you may recall, back in August, you made the determination to uplist Delta smelt from threatened to endangered based on the statutory definitions. What the motions that you're taking today are really the administrative steps under the Administrative Procedures Act to follow through on that previous decision. So the department hadn't planned on making any additional testimony. We certainly are available to do that if you want to hear sort of what our rationale was when we made that recommendation back in Carpinteria, but if we hadn't prepared any specific testimony on this.
Okay, thank you, Ann. Okay, commissioners, any questions? We do have one speaker.
Gary Bobker, Bay Institute.
Thanks, Gary Bobker, Bay Institute. Pretty hard to argue against the status of this population and its dire status, and therefore changing its the recognition of that status. We thank you for considering the petition. Thanks.
Thank you, Gary. Okay. Any other questions from commissioners or comments? Okay. John, would you read the suggested motion?
And there will be a motion for 10A and 10B. For 10A, the suggested motion is Fish and Game Commission hereby ratifies its findings of August 7th, 2008, that the petitioned action to add the Delta smelt to the list of endangered species is warranted.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 And suggested motion for 10B, the Fish and Game Commission, pursuant to the authority vested by Sections 2070 and 2070.5 Fish and Game Code, and to implement, interpret, or make specific Sections 1755, 2055, 2062, 2067, 2070, 2072.7, 2075.5, and 2077 of said code, hereby amends Section 670.5, Title 14 CCR, related to uplisting Delta smelt from threatened to endangered species status. Please note the regulatory language will be included in the Commission's website.
So moved.
Second? Do we have a second?
Oh, second.
Sorry, I was calling for a second. Not second either. Okay, any comments or questions? Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay, with that, then we're going to take our break for lunch and executive session. We'll reconvene at 2:15. Thank you very much. Great. Good afternoon, and we'll reconvene the commission meeting for March 4th, 2009. John, do you want to introduce the next item?
And before we get to the next item, I have an announcement. Earlier this morning, we had materials on the table out front, and these were Pacific Fisher Index and documents. If you pick those up and you're interested in, there was one piece of that puzzle, I'll call it, that we had forgot to put on the table, and that was a copy of a memo from the department to the commission on findings. And we do have copies. Anita has them if you wanted to pick that up, if you don't have that already. That moves us to item 11. And I'm going to read item 11, A, B, and C. And if you're interested in speaking on this item and you haven't turned in a speaker card, please do so to Mr. John Fisher over here. 11A is receipt of additional public testimony related to the petition to designate Pacific Fisher as a candidate and possible reconsideration of the petition to list the Pacific Fisher as a threatened or endangered species under the California Endangered Species Act. Depending on what happens with 11A, then it's possible that we will have 11B, which is consideration and possible adoption of findings, and then possibly go to 11C, consideration and possible emergency action to add Section 749.5, Title 14, CCR, related to special order relating to the incidental take of Pacific Fisher during a candidacy period. With that, we'll start with 11A, and I have Sankey on my list as speakers, but I think that's probably changed, or is it, are you the... kick 11A off.
It's me.
Awesome.
Good afternoon, President Gustafson, commissioners. My name is Sankey Mastrup, Deputy Director of Fish and Game. To kind of bring us up to current position we're in, I'd like to share a few things to update the department's perspectives on this, and I'll start with my conclusion, just so you know where all this is going in case I get lost. The department, it continues to recommend that the commission affirm its earlier decision and reject the petition and adopt findings under CESA consistent with that determination. With that said, there were two questions that were brought up at your last meeting regarding the department's report. And I'll address those two. And then also we received two recent letters that we've had a chance to quickly review and have some assessment of those two recent letters. So to the questions, we had a question from the commission regarding the source of the 250 animal population estimate in the draft status assessment for the fishery in California. And essentially that was that the source of that information was from a draft report which was not completed, and later the essentially when we looked at that, it was really baseless. There was really no data behind that number, and we considered it unsupportable and speculative, and that's why we didn't include that number as a solid number. I can go into more detail if you want. The other question was centered around the survey data in the South Sierras, that population down south, and I think the question was related, well, how good's that number and what would it take to come up with a good number down there? And essentially the data from the Southern Sierra population is derived from bits and pieces of studies that were not designed for the purposes of estimating that population. Essentially a comprehensive survey would require a very different sampling design and research protocol, which would be quite an undertaking and currently does not exist. So basically the Southern Sierra estimate's really not based on a really well-designed approach. So that's one of the reasons we think there's really not good information, a solid base for that information. The last two items are the late correspondence we got from Mark Jordan of Green Mountain College and Justin Augustine of CBD. They came in very late, so we didn't have a chance to really cover them well, but the bottom line on both of those letters is they don't bring up anything new or original that we haven't contemplated or addressed in our report. And is one of the reasons we're still sticking with our recommendation in the original report submitted to you for your August meeting. And with that, I'll try not to cloud the record anymore.
Thank you, Sankey.
We do have several public speaker cards on this item.
Okay, unless commissioners had questions from the department, we'll go to public comment, and then we might come back with questions.
Sure. Okay, please keep your comments to 3 minutes. We'll start with Justin Augustine, followed by Pamela Flick, followed by Walt Manzel.
Thank you. Again, I'm Justin Augustine. I appreciate that you're reconsidering the petition. I've laid out most of my argument in the letter that I submitted on Monday, and I hope that you find that persuasive. Also on Monday, the head of the department issued a memo that continues to assert that no reasonable person could find in favor of the petition. And, well, I find that to be a remarkable statement simply because of the fact that the majority of your own biologists examining the petition found in favor of the petition. So your department head is essentially telling you that that is owned biologists are unreasonable people, and that makes no sense, commissioners. Those biologists, of course, are not the only ones. You all received a letter, as was just pointed out, from Dr. Jordan. He states, quote, "The data clearly demonstrate a substantial decline in the fishers' distribution in California," end quote. He also points out that, quote, "There is not persuasive evidence in the commission's proposed finding that would undercut the importance of resting and denning habitat as an effective barometer of fisher health." And I would add that, contrary to the false assertions in the SBI letter, Dr. Jordan does cite two published literature from 2004, 2006 to support his conclusions. Another wildlife biologist sent you all a letter. He states, quote, "Not only are California's remaining fisher populations generally small and isolated, the species has a low reproductive capacity, poor dispersal ability. These factors, in combination with past and ongoing habitat loss, place the species at considerable risk of extinction. Such risk merits status review." Another wildlife biologist, who is a fisher expert, has stated that, quote, "The Southern Sierra population is in danger of extinction, not maybe." Also, the California Department of Forestry has declared that decades of selective logging have made timber stands on lands owned by SPI resemble nothing like the stands described in the published literature. And as I pointed out in my letter, SPI's own report, its own data show that fisher may be doing poorly on their habitat, on their managed lands. So, again, my point is simply that reasonable people have found in favor of the petition and provided numerous reasons for doing so. So I respectfully submit that a status review is the lawful and rational thing to do. If you don't mind, this may go over time, but I just want to address one thing very quickly. It should only take half a minute. This came up at the last meeting. A few of you stated that you are not swayed by threats of litigation. And I just want to clarify that nothing I've ever sent to you is meant to be a threat. I don't expect you to do anything simply because I might bring a lawsuit. Rather, everything I've sent to you is simply an appeal to reason. I hope you find what I have to say persuasive, and you know everything I've said is grounded in the law and the science. So I appreciate your time and your effort on all of this. I hope you take on a status review. Thank you.
Pamela Flick, Walt Manzel, Stephen Self.
Good afternoon, commissioners, commission staff, and department staff. Pamela Flick with Defenders of Wildlife. I would like to briefly mention that Defenders and other partners last week petitioned the Fish and Wildlife Service to list the northern fisher population in the northern Rockies, citing habitat loss and genetic isolation. I just wanted to point that out because it does clearly indicate that the fisher in the western United States are believed to decline, and not just in California or the Pacific Fisher DPS. Regarding the decision to list the Pacific Fisher before you today, I point out to the recent appellate court decision regarding California tiger salamander that set, quote, "The standard at this threshold in the listing process requires only that a substantial possibility of listing could be found by an objective, reasonable person," end quote. And bear in mind that the same population in question today, the distinct population segment of Pacific Fisher, including all of the fisher in California, was found to be warranted for federal listing by the Fish and Wildlife Service, although it was precluded due to competing conservation priorities and lack of adequate funding for listing. We believe that this fact alone would lead an objective, reasonable person to find that there is substantial possibility for listing to occur, and just request that you reconsider and move this petition forward. Thank you.
Walt Manzel, Stephen Self, Michelle Diaz.
Madam President, members of the Commission, Department staff, Walt Manzel representing California Rifle and Pistol Association. I've spoken on the Fisher for at least three different times, I think, in recent over the past few months. I'd just like to point out one little conundrum of this type of problem. The petitioners and people that are in their camp on this issue have pointed out before you, Commission, numerous times that there's not enough money for this, that certain user groups are not paying enough money for what they're demanding be done in the resource, shortage of funding for this project or that project. If you were to accept the Fisher as a candidate for listing, the department would be very hard-pressed to fund an adequate study over the next year. I don't know where the funding would come from, but probably out of the money spent by hunting and fishing license buyers who are not part of the petition process. So you're doing exactly what the petitioners have said all along we shouldn't do. You're transferring money from one group of people to pay for something that somebody else wants done. The specifics of the Fisher, the scientific evidence, I think, is very clear. Petitioner has not done anything that's added to the scientific data that was presented and found inadequate in the original meeting before you several months ago. Thank you.
Thank you, Walt.
Stephen Self, Michelle Diaz, Gary Reinierson.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. My name is Steve Self. I'm a wildlife biologist with Sierra Pacific Industries. I have quite a number of years of experience working with wildlife in the forests of California, including original research on Pacific Fisher and a number of cases. I want to talk a little bit about quality of Fisher habitat as it relates to SPI. As you know, there was a report in the early 30s, early part of the century, by Dr. Grinnell and colleagues, and they estimated based on primarily based on conversations with trappers, how many fisher they thought were in the state. And they came up with a pretty low number, and there's some question about that number. But one of the basis for that was how many, what were the capture rates for the trappers and how many they would catch in a particular area. And I just want to point out that Sierra Pacific and the other companies that are working with fisher regularly catch 4 to 6 times as many fisher on our properties as the trappers were able to catch during that time period. So that suggests to me that there are certainly more fisher, at least on our property, than where they were trapping in what Grinnell described as good fisher habitat. Now, the habitat that we're trapping them in is not continuous old-growth canopy forest, as some have described. As fisher habitat. We worked with experts from Fish and Wildlife Service and the Department of Fish and Game to do a study in the last few years on how fisher were using our property. And we used that information to develop a candidate conservation agreement that we were able to work with the Fish and Wildlife Service, and they agreed with us that those were good descriptions of habitat for fisher, that they did exist in areas on our property, and that they felt that there was a good chance that that could support fisher, and they signed a 20-year agreement with us based on that data. Fish and Game has also looked at that information with us as they helped us develop it, and has confidence that if they can get through their processes, that they feel that there's a good chance they could translocate fisher and put them on our property where those habitats exist. So experts from both of those agencies have been in the field with us, have done these studies with us, and agree with us that these look like good habitats and that fisher should be able to make a living there, such that the department and Fish and Wildlife Service are willing to undertake a translocation effort. I just wanted to point out lastly that in spite of all of what you've heard from the plaintiffs, the fisher is not threatened with extinction, nor is it likely to be threatened with extinction. In fact, instead, the fisher is poised on the verge of being reintroduced into suitable habitats in a former part of its range, which would not only additionally stabilize fisher populations in California, but it increased the number of fisher over time, because where fisher exists now is pretty well fully occupied. I think that's really all I want to say. There's been a lot of assertions about work that we've done, and that's all that they are. They are assertions. And if you have questions you'd like to ask about some of the recent things that have been submitted to you, I'd really like to answer those. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your time.
Michelle Diaz, Gary Reinierson, Chris Carr.
Good afternoon. Michelle Diaz. Oops.
That's okay.
Good afternoon. Michelle Diaz, California Forestry Association. CFA represents, or our members own, forest lands within the range of the fisher. And based on their management, CFA encourages you to confirm your August 8th decision on this matter. We believe that the department's evaluation of the status is sound and that no new information has been submitted by CBD or anyone else that merits a reversal of your previous decision. In fact, quite the contrary. One of the factors that CESA mandates you consider is the future management of the species. And with the pending translocation program between fish and game and private landowners, we believe that the management will actually improve the status of the fisher. So again, we encourage you to affirm your August 8th decision. Thank you.
Gary Reinierson, Chris Carr, David Moser.
President Gustafson and commission members, I'm Gary Reinierson. I'm a licensed forester with Green Diamond Resource Company. We have lands in Humboldt, Del Norte, and a little bit in Trinity County. We manage about 440,000 acres. We have two federal habitat conservation plans on those lands. One, our owl, Northern Spotted Owl Habitat Conservation Plan, covers our entire ownership in California, and we have about a 390,000-acre coverage with our habitat conservation plan for listed salmonids, along with a candidate conservation agreement for three other species. We also have on those lands a consistency determination for coho with the Department of Fish and Game. I raise those because those create very rigid buffers. They create standards in which we operate that over time will develop and are currently developing structural habitat that the fisher is currently using and will actually allow an expansion of that use on our property. We also have had in place for a number of years what we call a deadwood management plan that preserves downwood and preserves snags and other hardwood and large wood structures on our property, which are also, of course, a benefit to the fisher. We believe that and support the report that have been prepared by the department and believe that they do properly summarize the usage of non-late successional habitat, meaning non-old growth, including forests that we actively manage that are young growth, Douglas fir and redwood forest, and all of which have some component of tan oak, which also seems to benefit the fisher as well as certainly the northern spotted owl. Also, I'd remind the commission that in the last two decades or decade and a half, there's the fisher also, of course, utilizes a lot of habitat on national forest lands, and especially in the northwestern portion of this state, there's been a precipitous drop in the harvesting level activity on those lands after the listing of the northern spotted owl. For instance, Six Rivers National Forest, which is 1.1 million acres, used to harvest up to 150 million feet a year. Now they harvest less than 10 million feet a year. So the additional habitat that is especially in the northern spotted owl forest, the northwestern part of the state, as well as the California spotted owl plan that applies to most of the Sierras, does in fact address a lot of the issues that are also germane to the fisher. Thank you.
Just a quick question, Gary, if you don't mind. Given all the things that you're already doing, let's just say the fisher was listed, what would you need to do differently? If anything, given that you're already protecting all this habitat, do you anticipate that you'd need to do anything else?
That's a good question, Commissioner, and I think one that's not really come out directly. I've reviewed the 2084. However, those only represent an interim standard, and what would then come forward in the longer term is unknown at this time, and that certainly raises a great deal of uncertainty and a great deal of concern for us how that may be applied.
Chris Carr, David Moser.
Good afternoon, President Gustafson and members of the commission. I'm Chris Carr. I'm a partner at the law firm of Morrison & Forster in San Francisco, and I'm here on behalf of the California Forestry Association. I submitted a very brief two-page letter at the end of last week, which I believe you've been provided. I've also provided additional copies to Ms. Biederman. I really have three points that I'd like to make. Much has been made in the months following your August decision to reject CBD's petition. Much has been made by CBD about the so-called CTS decision, the third DCA's decision in the California tiger salamander case. And it's our view that the CTS decision does not in any way require or even suggest that your August decision was in any way improper. And we appreciate the consideration and prudent action that you've taken in wanting to carefully think through the question, what are the implications of the CTS decision? But in our view, the facts of the CTS case are radically different from that presented here, where you have, in the case of the Fisher, a very robust data set concerning Fisher population and range. You have abundant data that Fisher use intensively managed second growth forests, and you also have substantial evidence, overwhelming evidence, that the historic threats to the Fisher have been eliminated. Moreover, the CTS decision didn't alter the substantial possibility test that has been around since the NRDC case. It perhaps clarified it and expounded upon it, but it didn't alter the fundamental test that a reasonable person must find that there's a substantial possibility that the Fisher would go extinct. The Fisher facts are overwhelming and, I believe, preclude that finding. Finally, it's always, frankly, and no disrespect intended, it's an easy way out for a decision-making body to say that in light of an intervening Court of Appeal decision, the safe thing for us is to kick this down the road, have a status review, and see what shakes out at that time. But frankly, viewing the CTS decision that way is certainly not required by the CTS decision. As I indicated, Fisher facts are radically different. The CTS decision did not change the law. And you should also consider, I believe, the fact that if you cannot find it in yourselves to determine that it's appropriate to reject CBD's petition on this set of facts, then there will be no set of facts that I can imagine on any petition where the commission would be able to reject a petition and not advance a species to candidacy. So the broader programmatic and institutional interests of the commission in preserving its authority, preserving its jurisdiction over this core function in the listing process, and not abdicating its really superintendent role for the fish and game species of California, really, I believe, commends, if not compels, the commission in this case to reject CBD's petition in light of the CTS decision. Because if you can't do it in this case, I don't believe you'll ever be able to do it. And you would thereby surrender, needlessly, because the court's not compelling it, you would surrender an absolutely core function of the Fish and Game Commission. Finally, in addition to rejecting the petition, I would respectfully ask the commission to adopt findings, and I would request that you adopt the robust set of findings that the Department of Fish and Game has prepared. Thank you very much for your time, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
David Moser.
Good afternoon. I want to thank you again, David Moser from Eben Moser and Skaggs on behalf of Green Diamond. I want to thank you again for your careful and deliberate review of this petition and for the opportunity to address you. I also did submit a comment letter on Monday of this week, and what I sought to do in that letter is try to boil down what is a growing volume of information here to what I think are its most salient points, a couple of which I would like to emphasize here this afternoon. The question before the commission, front and center, is does the petition and the associated information before you contain that amount of information that would lead a reasonable person to conclude there is a substantial possibility that this species is in serious danger of becoming extinct? That's the standard under the Fish and Game Code. So let's look at what the record says. What's the factual record before you? What it shows is that the Fisher population and the Fisher range in California has not changed. In fact, if anything, has increased over the last 80 years. It's been stable for at least 80 years, if not having grown in the last 80 years. The record also shows, as Mr. Carr just mentioned, that the historic threats to this species have been eliminated quite some time ago, and that there are no new current threats to the species. The data set for the species is frankly quite unusual, and it's because the Fisher was an economic commodity, it was trapped and hunted by fur trappers. There was a lot of data gathered in the late 1800s, early 1900s. That's hardly ever the case in species that are petitioned for listing. And because of some early efforts over the last several decades, recognizing the sensitivity of the species, a lot of information has been collected and research has been done in recent years. So you have the benefit here, unusually so for petitioned species, of having a very comprehensive historic and current set of data about population, range, and threats to the species. So given that factual data set, what's the answer to the question? Well, if the species population and range has been stable for 80 years, and if anything has been increasing, and there's no new threats to the species, how could a reasonable person conclude that that species is now all of a sudden in serious danger of becoming extinct? That's the standard under the statute. We submit that they could not. I agree wholeheartedly with Mr. Carr's comments about the implications were the commission to reverse itself and now accept this petition. Under this set of facts, in my view, if you were to accept this petition, there isn't another species petition coming down the pike in coming years that you would be able to reject. You would be, in effect, giving up your decision-making authority. The legislature created a two-step process for listing species through the petition process. And this first step is critical, and it has very serious implications, whether you accept or reject. I don't think it's the commission's intent to surrender its decision-making authority here. And certainly, based on a threat of litigation that petitioners have made in the past, that certainly should not compel a change in your decision. It certainly should compel that you make the decision carefully and deliberatively, which you have been doing, and that you document that decision very carefully and thoroughly, so that in the event litigation occurs, you have a solid record for the court to review when it's going to evaluate your decision and the basis upon which you made that decision. The commission did have before it at the last meeting a draft set of findings. Submitted to you this week by the department is a more detailed set of findings that builds on the first draft of findings that was before you last month. In fact, much of that information and the text from that first draft of findings is incorporated in the more comprehensive set of findings that the department has prepared and submitted to you, which includes much more detail about the factual record and the conclusions to be drawn from that factual record. And we think that's the kind of set of findings that is prudent for the commission to adopt, both to give any reviewing court, should litigation ensue, clear explanation for what your reasoning was and what your conclusions were, but also to inform the public for all future CESA petitions about how you're going to go about making these evaluations and making these decisions. So with that, we respectfully request that you affirm your August decision to reject the petition and that you adopt the set of findings that was submitted to you this week by the department. Thank you very much.
That concludes public speaker cards for this item.
Okay, commissioners, do you have any questions for the department or any discussion that we'd like to hold? Go ahead, Commissioner Sutton.
Well, one, I'll start the discussion. First of all, I found it extremely difficult to digest and read and think about and consider all of the volumes of material that we received at the last minute, dated just a couple of days ago, including, frankly, the department's petition. I don't mean to be critical of the department, of the department's findings, I should say. I don't mean to be critical of the department, but and it goes for a lot of the parties in this case that we received material at the 11th hour. It's very difficult to wade through it all and come to a reasonable decision in that length of time. I realize that there are no deadlines that apply here, but we've been, you know, we've known that we're going to reconsider this for a month now, and to get these at the last minute makes our lives just more difficult, especially because the commissioners are not full time. We all have day jobs. We're all doing this on our own time substantially, and it just obviously would make it easier for us to digest all this material if we got it in a more timely fashion.
Okay. Any other commissioners want to add to the discussion?
No, except that, except to substantiate Commissioner Sutton's commentary. I personally found it very difficult, given the time constraints that we were given, to absorb adequately the information that was presented. I've had a real problem with that.
Well, I think the weightiness of the issue. I mean, certainly if we didn't find ourselves with kind of such unfortunate timing, I think not unfortunate timing in, as the other commissioners have talked about, but the timing of this decision in August and then the subsequent CTS decision. So, and how that has changed our world. And if I could just, and I hate to make light of something so important, but whenever you look at asking commissioners' political appointments sitting up here to be objective and reasonable people, you might wonder if the judge understood what he was dealing with. But all that being aside, that is kind of our standard that we are to use in this situation. So I think that we need to be very cautious in this situation. I think we're all very hesitant to talk about this in light of the changing dynamic that we face. So, is there, do you want to hear the suggested motions? We have a number of, oh, I'm sorry, Commissioner Sutton.
Go ahead. I was just going to offer a motion and my reasons for making it, but if you want to read them all first, whatever you like.
That's all right. I don't care. That's fine.
That's fine. I think you can make the motion.
Okay. I'd like to make a motion and just to predicate it by saying that based on my own review of the record, expedited though it may have been in recent days, I'm convinced that there is a substantial possibility that this animal is at serious risk of extinction and that it satisfies the statutory requirement to go to advance to candidacy. I'm basing that on a couple of things in particular, the letters from Professors Jordan and Barrett, two respected academic scientists who worked on this issue, the memos from department biologists, Osborne and Steele, which seem to oddly to contradict the department's own finding. Maybe it's the difference between field biologists and headquarters, but be that as it may, I think there's a substantial amount of information in this record that suggests that there is a substantial possibility that this listing may be warranted. And so I'm prepared to offer a motion. You want to read it, John? It's the one on page 15 of our, top page 15 of our. I don't trust myself to read the motion as well as you do.
The Fish and Game Commission hereby voids and sets aside the prior decision rejecting the petition to designate the Pacific Fisher as a candidate species for listing under the California Endangered Species Act, and hereby designates the Pacific Fisher as a candidate species. Furthermore, pursuant to Section 2074.6 of the Fish and Game Code, the department is to promptly commence a status review of the species and report back to the commission within 1 year from the date of the commission's findings concerning the petition with a recommendation as to whether the species should be listed as a threatened or endangered species.
So moved. And let me just add one thing based on a couple of comments we just heard. As a lawyer myself, and having read the record here, I reject the notion that somehow this decision, or if we vote this motion in, that it somehow ties our hands and means that we'll never be able to deny another petition. The standard for our review hasn't changed. I don't think that it means that we'll never be able to deny another petition. We're going to look at these. We're required to look at these on their own merits, each petition that comes before us. And I just don't think that we run the risk of having our hands tied and having to accept every petition and advance it to candidacy. That's not what's happening here, at least as far as I'm concerned.
So we have a motion. Do I have a second?
I'll second it, and I want to say something. I seem to be repeating what you're saying, Mr. Sutton. I'm not stampeded by any logic that in some way this in any way ties the hands of the Fish and Game Commission. If anybody thinks the Fish and Game Commission's hands are tied, I'm not going to be so bold as to say bring it on, but I think I might. There is virtually no way that this Fish and Game Commission is going to be corralled into doing consistently something that it wouldn't otherwise do. We take every single petition on a case-by-case basis, looking at all the factual implications that are submitted to us, hopefully in a timely fashion, and that is the way we will be making our decisions. So I don't think it implies anything with respect to the future.
Sankey, did you want to make a comment?
Yes, Commissioners, if I may. Since Commissioner Sutton brought up the two emails in the attachments presented by the petitioners, I have to, for the record, clarify that two emails do not make a majority view of the department. This issue, as we explained when we presented to you the June report in August, there was a lot of controversy. There was a lot of lively debate. We had an enormous number of experts weighing in on this, and there was a lot of anxiety on both sides of this, but that's the good news, is you have a department filled with a lot of very independent professional scientists, and science isn't always clear, and there was a lot of debate. In the end, though, once we got all the facts we could gather, and a lot of facts came in very late in this process, if I think we pointed that out back in August. In the end, though, with everything we understood and the biology we understand about this animal, the department did conclude that our final position, which we don't believe that this petition is warranted, regardless of an individual here and there. It's not fair to use those two emails to in any way portray a departmental viewpoint.
Well, I don't want to put words in Commissioner Sutton's mouth. He's been putting them in mine. I don't see that those emails as any evidence of anything wrong with the process at all. In fact, I celebrate emails like that because it means there's a robust, terrific interchange of ideas. I mean, if you guys were all lined up in a row, that would make me a little nervous. But I mean, it's because I know most of these guys, and that isn't the way they think. But having said that, that also means, if you go, another way to think about that is that also brings up this substantial possibility that given more time and more analysis, it could be that a comprehensive review over the next 12 months might indicate that the Fisher should be actually move out of candidacy. So I believe that this is the right thing to do, given the nature of this debate. It's all about the biology. It's all about the Fisher. We're trying to make certain to determine whether or not there is something going on with the Fisher that would lead to its demise. We don't want that to happen. I think there's enough evidence out there to trigger a 12-month comprehensive review.
Commissioner Richards.
Thank you. A couple things. And Richard, I appreciate those comments there. Particularly, I would want Sankey and the department and the audience and the people in the state to understand that the commission also can have robust debate and different opinions. And I have a wildly different opinion than the two that I've heard so far. I don't see any reasonable way any reasonable person could see this as a threat to imminent extinction. I think that is a stretch of mega proportions. And I respect very much my fellow commissioners, but I can assure you there's robust debate at our end about that, which is obvious by this discussion. And I would also say, in that spirit, I completely agree with Commissioners Sutton and Rogers that any actions we take for or against have absolutely no bearing, and with all due respect to the eminent counsel that was in front of us, I don't see that as practical. We will take a look at evidence, facts that are presented to us, and we'll make the very best decisions that we can. But making one decision based on one set of facts and a completely different set of facts on a different species at another date will not be impacted, will not impact how we're going to make those future decisions. And I would submit to you that we intend to look at each one individually with due diligence and try to make the absolute best decisions that we can.
Okay. Then I'll weigh in as well that I do disagree with some of the statements other commissioners have made. But in light of any doubt that I might have and in light of litigation that has already been determined, I find rather than lose all authority of the commission to ever consider these issues that I must weigh in being on the conservative side and saying let's give it 12 more months and let's get the studies out there and let's make sure all the documentation is in place. I agree very similarly with Commissioner Richards on this matter. That being said, so with that, I'll call for the vote. We have a motion and a second. All in favor? Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, we'll do a roll call. Okay.
Commissioner Richards?
No.
Commissioner Sutton?
Aye.
Commissioner Rogers?
Aye.
Commissioner Gustafson?
Aye.
Motion carries 3-1. That takes us to item 11B, consideration and possible adoption of findings. We do have some public speaker cards on that. I would like to get some comments from our Deputy Attorney General first for the commissioner's benefit.
Thank you. What I would suggest is that the commission give the staff direction to prepare findings that are consistent with the commission's decision today to present to them tomorrow. Keep this item open so that those findings can be considered at tomorrow's meeting. Is that, can I consider the nods that from the commissioners that that's direction given to your staff?
Yes.
Several of the cards here, I'm going to assume they all wanted to speak on 11A, B, and C. If you do not want to speak, just don't come to the mic, but I will be calling the names because several did put 11B and C. Steve Self, followed by Michelle Diaz, Gary Reinierson.
I'm a little confused now. We're on item 11C, is that correct?
No, 11B.
11B, which is
consideration and possible adoption of findings. Actually, we're
going to keep that open.
That's going to go over.
Actually, we will have those drafts tomorrow. So,
but if people have comment today, that
yeah, if you're
might
not
going to
be here tomorrow,
findings.
Also, if you're not going to be here, because some people are not going to be here,
you can speak to either.
Well,
11B
I'm
or
still confused. The findings don't support your decision, so I have no idea what to say.
The Deputy Attorney General just explained that the staff will draft findings to support that conclusion.
Well, then I can't say anything because I won't be here and I don't have any findings to speak to today other than the findings that you'd had drafted and that the department put forth for you were correct. And I'm disappointed that you've changed your mind about that. I think it's a mistake. And a lot of reasons have been put forward about that, and I agree with those. So thank you for your time.
Appreciate your comments. Again, those were the department's findings, not ours, until we take action on them. So I understand your concern.
Michelle Diaz.
From a procedural standpoint, Deb, do we need to take comments on 11B in case people have comment on it today, especially if they're here today and they may not be here tomorrow when we release those? So obviously, they can't comment on them.
Let me see if I can. Thank you. Let me see if I can hopefully clear up any potential confusion. The draft findings that were out prior to today's meeting, today's decision, were based on the decision this commission made in August of 2008. The commission has, according to its notice and its agenda, has changed its decision, has decided to move the petition, accept the petition for candidacy purposes for the Pacific Fisher, and you have directed the staff now to prepare findings that are consistent with its current decision. So those are the findings we'll be presenting to the commission tomorrow. If individuals, my suggestion would be, if individuals wish to make comments on any potential findings, they can do it today or they can do it tomorrow, or they can comment on the commission's change of position, given the information that they've had in front of them, et cetera. So, but the findings that were prepared earlier have not been adopted by this commission.
That's great.
Madam President.
So we're on 11B. Yes, Chris.
Chris Carr, again, on behalf of the California Forestry Association. Apart from disagreeing entirely with the substantive decision you've made, I feel it's incumbent upon me to point out that there are sort of grave procedural concerns raised by the actions that appear to be being proposed. Among other things, you have now taken a new action. That action just occurred. You have decided to accept the petition and advance the Fisher to candidacy. There was not agendized on the there's consideration and possible adoption of findings as item 11B. It doesn't say findings accepting a petition. It doesn't say findings rejecting the petition. However, there has been no draft findings presented and made available to the public for comment in advance of your findings decision. I appreciate that you are now saying you're going to be taking a decision on adoption of findings tomorrow, but that item, adoption of findings, accepting the petition, is not agendized for tomorrow. That's agendized for today. And as you just heard, Mr. Self is not available. He has other commitments. He's not able to hang out here overnight to be able to speak to, after presumably having an opportunity to review and critique your findings, he doesn't have an opportunity to do that. I believe it's procedurally inappropriate and profoundly unfair for the commission staff between now and tomorrow to go to the task of drafting findings and then put those before you tomorrow for consideration for adoption when no advance notice has been given to the public that your action adopting findings would be taken tomorrow, and there are no draft findings for review by the public in some reasonable period of time in advance of the hearing. So my own view is that it would be grave procedural error for the commission tomorrow to proceed to adopt findings without those having been properly agendized and without the public having been given a proper opportunity to review and comment on those findings.
Okay. Well, I'm going to allow the attorney to discuss these issues with the other attorneys here.
Well,
respond to those.
We certainly appreciate all the comments, and I know that I'm very able counselor at the podium and will make whatever arguments they feel are appropriate for whatever forum they feel is appropriate. I just would, however, point out for the record that in every agenda put out by this commission, including the agenda for today, it is indicated that items may be heard out of order, they may be heard on either day, and that is, the public is given notice of that, and I think that the commission will do whatever it can to accommodate individual schedules so they can comment on those items in front of the commission.
I would just say that even if it's possible to break up agenda items from one day to the next, and I think that entirely violates the spirit and intent of the public noticing provisions, that there isn't a draft available for the public to review.
Let me just ask for your patience for just a moment, because obviously this was a well-discussed item earlier and something that the commission's concerned about. I'd like to ask for a 10-minute recess so that we can converse with our legal counsel and make sure we understand procedurally what we can do and whether or not there's any findings, because we do have some comments, I think. But let me just take a 10-minute break to make sure we're on good grounds here.
Madam President, could I address the commission very briefly? I believe at the last commission meeting, in fact, I think at the last several commission meetings on the Fisher topic, The commission directed staff to prepare alternative sets of findings. Mm-hmm. To my knowledge, that has never occurred, and thus you are faced with the problem you're going to have a recess about, which is trying to craft findings overnight to be adopted tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I would request that the action, the agenda item of adopting findings be moved to your next meeting, and that the public have an opportunity to receive, well in advance of that meeting, a draft of findings so that we'll have something to comment on at the next meeting. Thank you.
Okay. Well, since we've asked to get things well in advance, we should certainly do that as well, shouldn't we? Take a 10-minute recess. Thank you. Okay, thank you for that break. We'll reconvene the Fish and Game Commission meeting. On items 11B and C, we will take action on these items tomorrow, but we do want to open up for any public comment today. And I know a couple of you already approached. If you'd like to come back up and take three more minutes and comment on 11B and C, we'll entertain any further comments on those today. Otherwise, we'll be back tomorrow. I'd also ask, because many of us on the commission haven't been through a whole lot of the of these items before, and John Fisher shared with me some information relative to findings in the past on these situations, and I'd like you to share that with the full commission, John.
Thank you. In the past, we've agendized the petitions to list for the first day of a commission meeting, and part of the reason for that was that if commissioners needed additional information that could be provided quickly, the item could be held over. And alternatively, the commission also wanted the ability to have findings prepared in a very quick fashion, too. And that has happened in the past regarding petitions. So this is not an unprecedented action that you are taking at all.
Sure, that was on the record.
Your mic.
I'm sorry. Thought I pushed it. If you speak on 11B and C today, we don't need to again allow public comment tomorrow on 11B and C. It's only for those who aren't going to be here tomorrow. Is that correct? Yeah. That's how I would prefer to do it. So are there any of you who can't be here tomorrow for items 11B and C that would like to speak to it today?
Thank you, Madam President. Chris Carr again on behalf of the California Forestry Association. I cannot be here tomorrow. I would like to speak on item 11B today, but because there are no draft findings to accept the petition, I'm unable to say anything on that subject. And I'd just like to reiterate that in my view, it is entirely inappropriate for the commission to be taking this action, given the procedural issues that have earlier been identified, and that the commission should not be reaching item C, the 2084 issue, before properly adopting findings, if that's what it ultimately does, with adequate notice and opportunity for public review and comment. Thank you.
David Moser again. Similar to Mr. Carr, I cannot be here tomorrow because of other obligations that I have. I would very much like to speak to the findings if there were findings available to speak to, which there are not. In responding to Mr. Fisher's comments, just because this practice has been employed before doesn't mean that it's a prudent or sound practice. It certainly doesn't serve the public well, in my view, and I don't think that that is a good or sound reason for rushing through to try to adopt a set of findings without any public notice of what those findings say in 24 hours. After all, it's been 8 months that the commission has been moving slowly towards adopting findings on its original decision. So the rush to adopt findings within 24 hours and deprive the interested stakeholders who have been at now four commission meetings on this subject any opportunity to participate in that process, I think, is certainly a faulty process. And as a result, I would reiterate my request that you hold this matter open to the next commission meeting so the public has an opportunity to review those findings that have been in process now for 8 months. Thank you.
Thank you. And certainly the commission does have the discretion to consider that request tomorrow.
Steve Self, finishing my remarks, I would like to comment on the findings. I will not be able to be here tomorrow. I would ask that you make those available and make your final decision on them at the next meeting so that the public does have a chance to comment on those. I have been at all the Fisher meetings so far, and I would hate to miss one, but I'm not going to be here tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Michelle.
Michelle Diaz, California Forestry Association. Again, I'm disappointed that you're not going to wait another month. I mean, this has been going on for some time now, and we've attended all the meetings. So I don't see that what harm in you waiting another month so that everyone has adequate notice. I will have to be here tomorrow. My members will expect me to be here. This is a huge issue for them, will impact them. So my question is, can we assume or can I request that this be early on the agenda? Because typically we've been like the last item and we sit literally all day. And so at least
I think that's a very reasonable request given this issue. And we will try to agendize you first thing in the morning.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other comments? So we'll continue on. Let's see. That's it for our agenda today. And we'll commence at 8:30 tomorrow morning. So we are adjourned for today. Thank you.